unlike the Senate, the House starts exactly on time. It is 2 o'clock, and we got a chuckle there. That's good. Well, welcome to the Transportation, Finance, and Policy Division meeting here in our mini-session in Winona. I'm so pleased to see so many folks have turned out, both from the public, and we have many members of our committee and a few guests also here as well, sitting around the table. I'm Frank Hornstein, the chair, and I'd like to welcome everybody. This is a regular meeting of our committee, so you'll be able to see many of the things we typically do in St. Paul. We will hear from our local officials here in Winona, and then we will hear from a couple of members of our committee who will present bills, and then there'll be public testimony for and potentially against those bills, and then we will open it up for the public to speak. And those are the three general things we do at any meeting. Before we start, we'll have introductions of everybody here around the table, but before we do that, I want to call on the mayor of Winona to give us some welcoming remarks. Thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you. Well, welcome, Chairman Hornstein, and members of the Transportation Committee. Like you, we start all our council meetings exactly on time. Reward those that arrive on time. I was asked to give a brief welcome, which I will do. I know you have a lot of business ahead of you this afternoon and a lot of testimony to hear. So I just want to say, like I did last night to probably many of you that were at the History Center, welcome to our city of Winona. It's a pleasure to have all of you here. It's a big deal for us, and I hope for you, too, to come here and learn about more about Winona and southeastern Minnesota, southern Minnesota. And I think it's a great thing for the citizens to be able to come here and watch you in action. Many of them don't get to the Capitol to do that, and I think it's a great way to sort of get through the bipartisanship that often is out there and preventing good things from happening. So we're here. I want to thank the city staff for everything that they've done. They've worked very hard to work with the legislative staff, and I think they've done a great job, and it's, again, a pleasure, and I'll see you tonight at the Marine Art Museum, and hopefully around tomorrow as well. But thank you for coming.
Thank you so much, Mayor Peterson. I want to echo your thanks to the staff and all of the wonderful, warm hospitality we've had for everyone from Winona. So thank you so much. What I'd like to do next is to have folks go around the room and around the table here and introduce themselves. And the members will say their names and what district they represent. We also have fantastic staff members here as well, and they'll introduce themselves and just briefly talk about what they do here at the House of Representatives. So why don't we start with Representative Wolgamott, and then we'll move around. And actually, before we do that, I wanted to call on my colleague, the ranking member, Representative Torkelson, to also make some opening remarks, as we typically do at these field hearings. And then we'll start with Representative Wolgamott. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Chair Hornstein. Appreciate that. I am Paul Torkelson. I serve District 16B in South Central Minnesota, Brown, Redwood, and some of Renville counties. Republican lead on this committee. Frank and I traded places after the last election. He had been the Democrat lead. He's now become the chair. I was the chair, and I've now become the lead. Elections have consequences, as we like to say at the legislature. So it's been great to be here in Winona in southeast Minnesota. It's my second trip to southeast Minnesota in just recent weeks. The Water Commission was down here just last week, the week before. So it's been a real treat to be here. Thank you, Mr. Mayor, for hosting us, and thanks to the community members and people that put a lot of work in to put this together.
Thank you, Representative Torkelson. And now we'll start with Representative Wolgamott.
All right, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Representative Dan Wolgamott. I serve District 14B, which is the St. Cloud area.
And I'm Representative Michael Nelson. I represent District 40A, which is the southern half of Brooklyn Park.
Representative Bob Vogel. I represent 20A. I live in Elko Newmark and represent southern Scott and western Lee Sore counties.
Good afternoon. I'm Sandra Mason, and I represent 51A, which is most of Eagan west of 35E and all of northern Burnsville.
I'm Representative Steve Elkins from Bloomington, District 49B, which also includes portions of Edina, Minnetonka, and Eden Prairie.
I'm Representative Aaron Cagle. I represent 37A, which is Blaine, Spring Lake Park, and Coon Rapids, the North Metro area.
I'm Alice Hausman. I represent a couple of neighborhoods in St. Paul, St. Anthony Park and Como Park, and three suburban cities, Falcon Heights, Lauderdale, and most of Roseville. If you've been to the State Fair, you've been to my district.
Hello, I'm Brad Tabke, representative for Shakopee, Jackson Township, and Louisville Township on the southwest side of Minneapolis. And thank you so much for having us here. One of them has given us a really, really great welcome, and we appreciate everyone for spending their time and hanging out with us.
I'm Lindy Selmick. I'm the committee legislative assistant, so I assist this committee and Chair Frank Weinstein in all of his legislative duties.
And we welcome Ms. Selmick. She just started last month and is doing a great job and did a lot of work to put this together. Again, Frank Hornstein, I represent the district in Minneapolis, parts of downtown and southwest Minneapolis.
Hi, folks. John Howe, the committee administrator. I've had the great privilege of communicating with many of you and look forward to hearing from you today.
And a big thank you to Mr. Howe, who's done incredible work over the last couple months putting this hearing together and all of our activities that the Transportation Committee has been involved with here in Winona. So thank you, Mr. Howe.
Good afternoon. I'm Linda Runbeck, a state representative from 38A, which is the northern suburbs, Lionel Lakes, Circle Pines, and several other cities up there. So thank
you. I'm Nolan West. I represent most of Blaine in the Minnesota legislature.
My name is John Kosnick, represent Lakeville, which is 25 miles south of Minneapolis and St. Paul, just off Interstate 35.
And I'm Matt Burris with House Research, which is one of the nonpartisan offices in the House.
Joe Marble, I'm the, used to be the committee administrator for Paul. I'm now the researcher for the House GOP for transportation.
I'm Jennifer Nelson, I'm the Danville researcher with this committee.
So thank you, everyone, for those introductions. And now we'll start with some local officials from the city of Winona, and then we'll hear from some of our esteemed guests. We have two state commissioners that have made the trip down here, and we'll hear from them in just a couple of minutes. But as we have learned through the day today and through much of our work in this committee, there's a very, very important connection between transportation and local economic development. It is critical, as we know, for commerce and for jobs. And so we know that Winona has been exemplary in this area. The way that the Port Authority has, looked at some of the redevelopment that we've seen downtown and, of course, all of the farm and other products that are shipped along the river, on the port. These are all critical transportation issues and needs. So we will have Mr. Al Thurley first, who serves on the Winona City Council, and he's also a Port Authority Commissioner. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you. It's the first time I've had legislature on the ground here.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name again is Al Thurley. I'm a member of the City Council and Port Authority of Winona. And in fact, I participated as a council member during the last mini session in Winona 30 years ago. But I haven't been on the council all those years. I missed 8 years. But it's a great event, and thank you again for coming back to Winona. And thank you for the opportunity to tell you about the Winona port facilities as well as the other active public ports that serve the state of Minnesota. Now, here's some information to start with about how valuable our port facilities are to the entire state. The Mississippi River and the Great Lakes waterway system provide us with access to national and international markets with the lowest cost transportation available. Now, at the Port of Winona, some of the major commodities that move through the state and into the state through our facilities are road salt, we need that in Minnesota, fertilizer, we need that in Minnesota, distillers grain, it's an interesting product of the ethanol process, and a product called Gypsoil, which is fairly recent, but it's a soil treatment. And we have also seen a significant increase in shipments of wind turbine components, such as the blades. They come up the Mississippi River on barges. It's an amazing sight to see four or five of these huge wind turbines, specially built cradles on these barges coming up from New Orleans, and then offloaded here in Winona. It's kind of neat. And then they're transported by truck from Winona to wind farms in western Minnesota, in Iowa, and in the Dakotas. Now, some of the things that go out of the Winona port are primarily grain shipments, corn, soybeans for the most part. And unfortunately, given the challenges facing farmers these days, having a low-cost option for movement of their products to market is a significant benefit. The Port of Winona and our colleagues in Red Wing, St. Paul, and Duluth rely on the Port Development Assistance Program to repair and upgrade our port infrastructure. This program was enacted in the early 90s, and the legislature has provided matching funds, thank you, usually in the form of general obligation bonds, to improve dock walls, enhance our heavy lift capabilities, store products for transshipment, construct stormwater drainage systems, and construct facilities to accommodate barge fleeting activities. And we have, from time to time, received general fund appropriations, which have come through the Transportation Finance Committee. Those appropriations are always welcome, as the general fund allows us to finance equipment for moving products at ports, something that general obligation bonds cannot pay for. The ports are unified in their support for the Port Development Assistance Fund. We have a short list of projects to use up to $14 million of state general obligation bond proceeds in the coming session. The projects we have lined up will enhance our ability to serve a vital role in Minnesota's multimodal transportation system. Now, one of our handouts shows you examples of projects at the Port of Winona, past, present, and future, that has or will receive funding through the Port Development Assistance Program. Now, we acknowledge that the ports need rail and truck service in order to serve the role we play in moving commodities into and out of the state. But to give you a sense of the scale of port operations, we have a handout that compares the movement of commodities by barge versus rail or truck. The easiest reference is provided in the handout, which examines the equivalent capacity of one barge on the Mississippi River, which carries the same amount of product as 16 rail cars or 70 large semi-trailer tracked units. The benefits of our public ports were best described by a former member of the Minnesota Ports Association, Duluth Port Director Davis Helberg, who passed away late last year. He would always say, quote, "Waterborne commerce uses less energy, causes less environmental degradation, generates less waste disposal, is responsible for fewer accidents, creates the least societal disruption, and is almost cheaper," unquote. In addition, having this option available reduces wear and tear on a highway system. We are grateful for the opportunity to talk to you about our port facility, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for bringing our committee and the whole legislature to Winona. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Thurley. Do we have any quick questions for the council member and Port Authority Commissioner? Thank you for your testimony. Next, we have Mr. Brian DeFrang, the Winona City Engineer. Welcome to the committee, Mr. DeFrang. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I am Brian DeFrang, city engineer for Winona. welcome to Winona. Appreciate you being here. We really could give you a little better weather, but makes it easier to be inside. Tell you a little bit about how transportation works in Winona. Approximately 20% of our streets are Minnesota State Aid funded. That gives us money from the state aid through the gas tax at about $900,000 per year is what's given the city of Winona. That's to be spent on reconstruction or matching of funds when a trunk highway or a county highway is done in town and we're obligated to pay a portion of it. That also leaves 116 miles of street that are not funded by state aid. That costs approximately $2 million a mile for a city street to be reconstructed totally, which over 116 miles gives us approximately $250 million worth of reconstruction cost to fully reconstruct our streets. There's a lot of streets that need to be reconstructed in the Allstate. Many cities, just like Winona, face the same problem. And we don't have a great dedicated source of funding. Recently, the counties have been given the opportunity to do a half-cent sales tax, which the cities have not been able to. And it costs approximately 50% to do a rural highway mile as it does to do a city street mile with the curb and gutter, the storm sewer, the sidewalks, the wider pavement to accommodate parking, etc. So a city street is much more expensive to do than a rural section, whether that's a MnDOT highway or a county highway. The county roads in Winona, we have about 30% as many roads as they have. And they have a funding source which we do not have. So I wish the council would consider some sort of amendment to that, to where we could either give a sales tax or possibly different funding from the gas tax, which may have been talked about. Also, the bridge bonding bill, Winona's had a bridge on there for over 2 years that has not been funded because the bonding bill has not funded bridge bonding very well in the last few years. It has been funded, but not at the level that it's needed. It's something that we would like to be looked at. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. DeFrank. Questions from the committee? We appreciate your testimony and your work. Next, we have Monica Hennessy-Mohan. She's the city clerk and also the administrator of Winona Transit. So welcome, and for the public and of course members, we are interested. We fund transit in the metro area as well as through the Metropolitan Council primarily, but some of the opt-out transit services. But also, we have a strong interest in Greater Minnesota Transit, and that is through MnDOT. And we're very interested in hearing your perspective on transit here in Winona. So welcome to the committee.
Again, my name is Monica Hennessy-Mohan. I am the city clerk here in Winona. And because we're a smaller city, I also do a number of duties, one of which is administering our Winona Transit service. In a former life, I used to work for the city of Minneapolis, and I lived in the lovely Kenwood neighborhood.
Oh, former constituent. <That's what>
So Winona Transit, I did have a double-sided handout for you, and I also provided copies of our current routes. Winona Transit serves both the cities of Winona and Goodview, and now with our new dial-a-ride service, we're providing service up to 2 miles outside of our current city limits. So we provide three different types of service. The first is what we call a deviated route service, where we have four routes, but they will deviate up to four blocks off that route for an additional surcharge. We currently run Monday through Friday, 6 a.m. to 6:15 p.m., and Saturday, 9 to 5. We just started running something called Dial-A-Ride, which is a demand response service, and this runs the same days and hours as our other routes. And that service is for all of Winona and Goodview and up to 2 miles out. We also run a number of college subscription routes, And these are under an agreement with Winona State University as well as St. Mary's. We run three routes for Winona State during the school year, and this is between their main campus, the West Campus, which is the former St. Teresa's University, and their East Lake Apartments. And important route that we run is called the Safe Ride, and that's a free service that runs on Friday and Saturday evenings between the universities in downtown. Our current service, we have 8 Class 500 buses and 1 Class 400, so a total of 9 buses that we're providing 9 routes. Our fares currently are $1 for the deviated routes and $1.30 for the dial-a-ride. At the bottom of that page, you'll see our stats from last year. And overall, we provide over 13 trips per hour, which is good for an out-state transit service. So the current funding for all these routes, we receive 80% of our operating costs through a grant by MnDOT. A lot of that is through FTA grant funds. And through the state of Minnesota, it's both general fund money and the Greater Minnesota Transit Fund. I would note in 2019, MnDOT increased that that grant money to include 90% of our operating costs. So a vast majority of our costs are covered through MnDOT grant. The balance is a local share, and in Winona, we cover that through our bus fares and some limited advertising on the buses. Winona State is paying 100% of those routes. And the capital cost for bus replacements is typically also at 80%. Some of the current projects we've had in the last year, it's been busy for Winona Transit. We implemented a new transit advisory committee made up of local residents and service organizations. Through MnDOT and the MIPTA, the Minnesota Public Transit Association, we were able to complete a 5-year transit plan. We're just finalizing our plan. It will be coming to our city council the next month. And earlier this year, we received a special grant from MnDOT to increase the number of shelters and signage that we have throughout our system. The total grant was $242,000. Again, that was on an 80-20 match. And we recently completed a route redesign. It's the first time in a couple decades that we've changed the structure. We have delayed implementing those routes until we get some of those new shelters actually in place. I'm also a member of the Southeast Minnesota Regional Transit Coordinating Council, RTCC, that MnDOT is working on throughout the state. We have one of the largest coordinating councils in the state. It, I believe, has 8 counties that are participating in that. And Olmsted County is in the process of developing the grant application for year 2 of the planning. We have a grant application into MnDOT for some bus replacements for next year. We have not heard back yet on the status. But I am happy to announce that our application for expanding our service to the evening through our evening dial-a-ride has been approved, and we will be looking to implement that in early January of 2020. So again, thank you for all the support of our transit system. Obviously, we cannot provide those services without the financial assistance from the state and also the staff assistance from the MnDOT Office of Transit.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hennessy-Mohan. Are there questions? Yes, Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your presentation. It's very informative. I was just curious on the safe ride to the university and back. If I understood you right, the university pays
so
for
both
that?
Winona State and St. Mary's pay about 70% of it. The balance is from our transit grant.
Okay. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, and then just is the difference from coming from a metro suburban district. It doesn't appear, I tried to pull it up here, so Uber and Lyft network transportation providers are not utilized in the city of Winona, or there's not a driver available, at least right now.
Right. I believe we do have some Lyft drivers, but it is pretty minimal.
Okay.
Thank you. It's a good question, Representative Kosnick. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Representative
Runbeck, sorry,
thank
I didn't
you, Mr.
see
Chair.
You.
Just wanted to question, so the WSU routes, do they use a different type of vehicle than the deviated routes?
No.
Just noticing.
They are all public transit buses. Are all signed with Winona Transit logos.
Okay. The operating costs, even though the passenger trips are about the same, operating costs are much more in the deviated routes. I'm just curious why that would be.
Lieutenant Simone.
So the annual operating costs for the deviated routes, they run year-round, and they run more hours per day. So the Winona State subscription routes are only during the school year, and they run on different hours. One of the routes is only 2 hours a day, one is 4 hours, the other is 12 hours. So quite a bit more hours of routes of service for the deviated routes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
So that concludes our panel from the City of Winona. And it's reminded when we had the municipal officials here that we have a former municipal official who is a member of the legislature who is sitting in the audience, Representative Carlson from Bloomington. And he formerly was a member of this committee in the past. We miss him, but I know he's doing good work in other committees. But we welcome him to our meeting. So now we'll hear from some county officials. We already had a tour this morning, but we want to elaborate and expand on some of that. Of course, counties receive 29% of the state aid transportation formula and are very, very critical partners. So our first representative from the Winona County Board is Chris Meyer, a county commissioner. Mr. Meyer. So we have the
Thanks.
Yeah.
Members of the chair, I want to welcome you to Winona. My name is Chris Meyer, and I am a Winona County Commissioner. I really have just three simple thoughts that I wanted to share with you today about transportation and transit in Winona County. First, and very simply, we need more road funds. Winona, as a number of other counties have, has levied a sales tax, and that does help us to assist in our road maintenance and construction. And so every year we do get a little bit more done than we did before, but in reality, we are just falling behind more slowly. So consistent and higher funding is needed for us to keep up our infrastructure. Across all of southeastern Minnesota, some 50% of our workforce commutes to some other county every day for work, and that is even higher in Winona County. Of the 15,500 jobs that we have, about two-thirds of our workers come from someplace else in the region, and about 8,800 workers leave Winona County every day to go somewhere else in the region for their job. We lack a regional transit system for commuters, and that creates an equity issue. It makes car ownership a prerequisite for some employment. And though MnDOT is working on the coordination council, the focus of that is really not on commuters. Additionally, we are experiencing a workforce shortage, and that is expected to just get worse in future years. So transit for commuters that would work for us regionally is important, and it would be important for us to address second and third shift issues so that we can get folks to be working for the businesses that we need to support and that will help us maintain our economic development. So state support in planning and developing and funding roads and transit are really important to all of southeastern Minnesota, but especially to us.
Thank you very much. Questions? Yes, Vice Chair. Representative Tabke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with you that we absolutely have to have more funding for transportation throughout the state of Minnesota. What ways, in your mind, do you see is the best mechanism and way for helping to make that happen? Like, what do you see the funding best created as?
So for regional transit?
Mostly for roads and bridges and make funding roads that way, but also for transit as well.
Sure. So I'm not sure if Dave Kramer, who is our county highway engineer, who's here today, he's going to speak.
I rely on his expertise in terms of many of those details. So I'm not sure what the right mechanism is for funding, but I know that we need it to be consistent and that we need help.
And Mr. Kramer will be testifying next.
Okay.
There we go.
Perfect. And just to kind of follow up on that, like politically, is in your mind, is gas tax a way to go? Is what do you think is the right way that people in your county can handle and what they think is a good idea?
Sure. Well, personally, I'm not opposed to the gas tax, and I understood that there was a straw poll at the state fair this year, and that 60% of Minnesotans who took part in the poll said they'd favor 5% or more, right? I think, too, as we look towards electric vehicles, maybe a vehicle miles traveled tax would be a more equitable way for us to figure out how to fund those.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and Representative Cagle.
Thank you. This morning we heard a bit during the jobs committee about the driver's license for all issue, and was just wondering, you know, if that would help some of the workforce issues that you are facing here.
Yeah. So I was just elected in the 2018 cycle. I sit on the workforce board here in Winona County, and I have had a lot to learn just becoming an elected official. And there are three things that they tell me are really critical to us being able to get those folks who maybe could work but don't. And one of those is transportation, one of them is housing, and one of them is childcare. So certainly, the issues with being able to have a driver's license, I was really surprised at this. The last workforce meeting, which was on Monday, one of the folks from Deed that runs our Career Force Center was talking about how Ashley Furniture has been recruiting folks from Puerto Rico. They're bringing them to Winona, and they're bringing to Arcadia. So certainly our employers are trying to help recruit folks to come from outside the region. So certainly, I mean, folks from Puerto Rico are going to have an American passport, so that'll be fine. But for folks who come here from other countries and are working, yeah, it would be really important for them to be able to have a driver's license, to be able to insure their vehicles. And you know, I thought it was great that Sheriff Andrew talked about why that's so important to long-term as well.
Thank you. Additional questions? Oh, yeah. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. Just briefly, I'm aware that there are commuter buses that run to Mayo and Rochester. I believe it's a private system. Does that operate here in Winona?
I think it's Rochester City Lines, and that they do have buses that run on a Mayo schedule. I don't know that that's available maybe in as wide a format as is needed, and I'm not sure what buses there are that would run to La Crosse. But I think that probably to Rochester and across, for folks who leave Winona, those are the places that they're going.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we all thank you very much for your service and for your testimony. Our final Winona County testifier is Mr. Dave Kramer. And, of course, we welcome back to the committee. You gave a wonderful presentation this morning. A couple of things I wanted Mr. Kramer to touch on that he didn't touch on today, this morning, is that I'm especially interested, given so much of the rain that has fallen in this part of the state and throughout southern Minnesota, we'll be hearing again from our state agencies on this as well, I checked with the National Weather Service in La Crosse. They said last year was the third wettest on record. I'm hearing now that it's now the wettest on record in this part of the state so far in 2019. So I think there's some issues with that and how we address that in road construction and repair. And then just in general, overview of the engineering issues related to roads here in the county. So a couple of things that we can amplify that you had mentioned this morning, and welcome to the committee, and thanks again for spending so much time with us.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. Regarding the funding as a whole, just to expand a little bit, the Winona County Board did approve the half-cent sales tax for transportation. I believe that was in 2016. Some information that I put together at that time for the board's consideration We looked at a kind of a life cycle cost analysis for our bridges, our roads, both bridge replacement, overlays on roads, and reconstruction of roads, and we came up with basically an annual need of $8.8 million. Looked at all of our revenue sources, which the bulk of that is the county state aid highway funds, which come from the highway user tax distribution funds, and the revenue was about $4.4 million, so it's about a 50% gap. And we do have empirical data, not empirical data, actual numerical data from road conditions that numerical data every 4 years that MnDOT provides that shows our roads in good condition are becoming less percent and our roads in poor, very poor condition are increasing. So we're definitely falling behind. The board did approve the half-cent sales tax. Right now that's tracking for the last year of very close to $3.0 million that will generate. In comparison, our CASA construction funds are about $3.6 million. So it's a huge shot in the arm to, as Commissioner Meyer mentioned, we're falling behind less slowly, much less slowly, but we're still, we're not in catch-up mode. We're in, fall behind slower mode. So just to be clear about that. As far as, revenue, or potential sources, certainly the gas tax is kind of the workhorse of the Highway Users Tax Distribution Fund with the electric or, hybrid vehicles. Obviously, there needs to be a look at something that's mileage-based. But, for what will work now, I believe that's the workhorse. And if you look at the variation of the, the gas prices, and if a 5, 10, 15 cent increase were to be, worked in over time, I really can't imagine people would even realize it happened, frankly, unless they read the paper and saw gas taxes being increased. A couple other things I'd like to talk about with the now you should all have the handouts. Bridge bond funding, I've got a real concern about that and would like to put a pitch in for that. As we were trying to work, when I was working with Mr. Howe to schedule the tour, I would have liked to have gotten you all out and looked at the underside of one of our bridges. I gave him some GPS coordinates, and he plunked them in. He said, I don't think that's the right spot. It was too far away from Winona. I said, no, that's my bridge. On the first page here, the top sheet's kind of a map showing all of our bridges. I got it circled in red there. It's on our County 5, just north of the county line with Houston County, our bridge 85502. It is load posted right now for 16-28-28, which means 16 tons for a single vehicle, 28 tons for a vehicle with a trailer or a semi. To put that in comparison, a normally legally loaded tandem axle truck can haul 26 tons. So that is significantly less than that. And then a normally legally loaded semi, 80,000 pounds or 40 tons. So the 26-40-40 that was on the bridge that I pointed out on a tour is basically matches the normal legal loads. Like a milk truck with extra axles can go higher than that. If you put more axles on a single unit vehicle, they can go up to 80,000 pounds, which is why that bridge is load posted safe. It's not safe for that smaller vehicle that would put all that load on a single bridge span. So I do have concern about this bridge. I like to get my county commissioners out on a road tour once a year, and usually we'll go under a bridge and look at some of the things. And, you look at the, on the first page, the bottom, you look at the picture of the bridge there, that looks just fine. Get underneath it, and the, there's some pretty serious deterioration. The bottom side of the bridge there is falling, and the reinforcing steel is rusted. And then I have a picture on the bottom of page two, the bridge pile there is, and that's what's holding the bridge up. It's literally rusted through. So we've had this bridge in our replacement program we were planning for 2015. We've been deferring that since then due to the bridge bond funding not clearing out the backlog. So right now we have it tentatively planned for 2021 based on some bridge bond funding in the 2020 legislature. Typically, the request that comes out is in the 50 to 100 million range. I believe the current backlog is actually about that big. So, I know it's kind of a mundane thing that sits there year after year, and it's maybe not as flashy as other projects, but it really is a bread and butter thing that's critical for our infrastructure. Just wanted to mention that. The other thing that was asked about was the flooding. On the next page three, that specific bridge, that's a picture of what it looked like after the August 18th, 2007 flood. It was just sitting there on its pile. The next page, on the bottom of page three, you can see that the bridge approaches are completely washed out. You can see on the end of the bridge there is that bridge identification plaque is the one that they have on the picture on the first page. So we filled that back in, and you know it has a traffic back on it. Top of page four, you can I kind of pictured on the top of the pier there, there's some spalling from some stresses that were put on that bridge during that flood. That's not the main thing we're concerned about, but it is some deterioration that's of concern. Moving ahead to this year, we've had two disaster events this year. We had the spring runoff event, which was a declared disaster for most of the counties in Minnesota. It's also a federal disaster. Our damage on that was actually relatively small, in probably the $70,000 range. We also had a thunderstorm come through on July 19th, early that morning, in the southeast part of the county, dumped about six inches of rain. What the locals were telling me, that was on top of a couple inches the day before, so not very much soaked in. Starting on the page bottom of page four, you can see some photos there of some of the damage. Page five, those are all that same road. Page six is one of our roads through the valley that overtops, so we're basically back in there putting gravel in that next morning, trying to get that back open. As far as the this specific flood, is about $500,000 of damage to our county road system. We're repairing about $200,000 of that in-house, and about $300,000 of that we have contracted out. It's my understanding that paperwork to get a disaster declaration to the governor was submitted to him recently for his signature. I want to put a plug in for the state disaster program. This was localized, so this will not be a federal disaster, but there is significant damage on the county side, and to have that state disaster program where we'll be eligible for 75% reimbursement, that is, that's a great program to have when we have things like this happen. The 25%, we can absorb with some reserves, but to take care of the brunt of it, it is nice to have, kind of a public infrastructure self-insurance pool with that disaster program.
Thank you very much. Again, appreciate your testimony today and your accompanying us on the very informative tour this morning. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At what point do you have to start closing bridges?
Well, this one, the load posting that we have on it is that road is safe to cross. You have to close a bridge before it becomes unsafe. They can be load posted down to a 3-ton limit on a bridge like this where it's got quite a bit of truck traffic on it. That's not a realistic posting, but when they do become unsafe for any traffic, like for even a car to drive across it, we would close it.
It looks like here that there's 17 deficient bridges. Are any of them getting to the point that you might consider having to close them for safety?
Mr. Kramer.
None of them are that close. Probably the closest one we have is in the very southwest corner there. You see the one that says a weight limit 5 tons. That's on a township road. Very limited traffic, and that's one where it probably will be closed and not replaced when it's no longer safe for traffic. But we do annual bridge inspections, and so we're monitoring them. They periodically get a structural engineer to analyze them for load rating, and then we'll update the signage. So there's a rigorous inspection and analysis program, and we don't leave them open if they're not safe to be open for the load that they have posted or the normal legal load.
Thank you, and again, thank you very much. Any other questions? Okay. Well, I appreciate the testimony from the city and county officials. I think cities and counties, local government, are really on the front lines in many ways of our transportation challenges that we have, and we want to continue to work with you as partners here at the state level and, of course, get you the resources you need to be successful. And so, speaking of states, state-level folks, we definitely wanted to hear from our two commissioners over. We have jurisdiction over a number of different agencies and entities at the state level. First and foremost is MnDOT and also the Department of Public Safety. We also, as I mentioned earlier, fund the Met Council. That's not a state agency per se, but the Met Council chair does sit in the governor's cabinet. So those are the three main agencies. Of course, there's others as well. But we do have today the commissioners of Transportation and Public Safety, and I'll call on Commissioner Margaret Anderson Kelleher first. And again, we typically hear from agencies on many bills. They will give us overview presentations at the beginning of each session. That from time to time they issue reports, and then they will brief us about those reports. And we have one such report as well. And members, a lot has happened since we last met in spring. And so, and a lot of activities at MnDOT too, too many to go through today. But I thought that the report that they issued on climate was important and carbon. And so we'll hear from Commissioner Anderson Kelleher on that. And just to preface the comments, we'll have the commissioner go through her PowerPoint, and then we'll save questions till the end if members have those. And I also, as a prerequisite to this presentation, transportation is now the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions, and it is the fastest growing source. And so I think this is why this Pathways report is so important and so timely, given, again, the realities of the climate crisis that we've experienced not only in Minnesota over the summer with our extreme weather events, particularly flooding, but of course we've had fires and where we shouldn't have fires over the summer around the world, and more and more reports almost every day of accelerating climate change. So that's part of what is behind this report, and we'll take a look at that now. So welcome to the committee. Welcome to Winona, Commissioner Anderson Kelleher.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, thank you. Thank you for having me down here. Thank you to the mayor, to council members, to the county commissioners and county staff who are here. I appreciate their work. I'm no stranger to Winona. One of the most significant times when I was here was when the region experienced flooding when I was Speaker of the House. And I was thrilled today when we saw many of the things that they have done since that time that have helped them be more resilient. And so I want to preface this by saying a lot of the work in transportation today that's forward-looking, like you just heard a lot of things that are very immediate about how counties and cities are responding to immediate needs in transportation, both funding shortages, issues with flooding, and you're going to hear a little more about that in my presentation. But a lot of the work that's being done that's forward-looking is looking at resilience and looking at how communities, how states, how our country are going to respond in the next 10, 20, 30 years. And that's what this report looks at. And so let me start by just saying that in 2007, the state passed the Next Generation Energy Act and set goals for our state for greenhouse gas reduction. We are going to hit the 2015 mark was hit. We are not on the track for the 2025 mark, nor are we on track for the 2050 mark. And the biggest reasons why we are not going to hit those goals are because of the transportation sector. Now, just as Chairman Hornstein said, Energy has rallied up. They have hit their goals, and they have brought their greenhouse gas production down. And I think there's some reasons, and we could talk about that, why that has been successful as a sector for energy. And this report lays out some ideas how the transportation sector could be successful in bringing down greenhouse gases. The chairman was talking about what has been happening. The 30-year average minimum winter temperature has been going up in Minnesota. And although we could say that maybe that's a good thing, it's really not. It makes us wetter. And we are having the wettest year that we have had in recorded climate history in Minnesota. And that is why you are seeing scenes like this. In June 2019, this is Trunk Highway 52, just south of Pine Island. We do not advise you to drive through water at MnDOT, so let me just say that. It's not a good idea. And some of the things that this means at MnDOT, how do we respond to these sorts of things as we're planning? We are changing how we do things. We are putting into our asset preservation new modeling about how we will respond and plan our roads because of these temperature changes. We have to plan for different types of pavement responses, both in how we clear the pavement and how the pavement responds, all of these sorts of things. So, it has consequences today to what's happening. When you look at the emissions by economic sector from 2005 to 2016, you can see what's happening here. This is where the decrease in the electric sector has been pretty significant, and where other sectors have not been having quite a significant of a decrease. You may wonder, why MnDOT? Why are we doing this? We actually do have statutory authority to study the greenhouse gas reduction, and that is exactly why we undertook this study and to begin this planning and to be able to really analyze how would we advise reducing greenhouse gases in the transportation sector. So, when you look at surface transportation sector, you're going to see that the major surface transportation producers are broken out here. And we look at these in detail in the work that we've done to say, what does it look like going forward? So we gathered together. We led the way on this study. We weren't alone. The EQB worked with us. The PCA worked with us. The Department of Ag worked with us. We coordinated over 50 state and national technical experts on the study, private, nonprofit sectors as well to inform the study. We modeled strategies to be able to reduce the greenhouse gases, and we did public engagement around this because we know that to be successful in having any sort of accepted greenhouse gas reduction, the public needs to be behind the recommendations or it will not be able to move forward. So, what did we do here to say modeling out? So we did a baseline study and said, if we do nothing and just look at, you know, normal acceptance of electric vehicles coming forward, what will happen? And what happens is we have a slight reduction of greenhouse gases and then it goes up again. So we actually focused on these two scenarios. One is 80% reduction by 2050, and one is 100% reduction by 2050. And the focus is really on these two scenarios in the report. So the pink is the fuel economy standards. And so those are the current federal standards for all vehicles to make them pollute less per miles traveled. And that is looking at what you heard the governor announce last week, going through a rulemaking process with the PCA leading the way to have more choice available on the floor of a dealership, thank you. So Minnesotans could choose more low emission cars and electric vehicles. Because what's happening today out there is we only have a small number of those vehicles available in Minnesota. The red line is reducing the number of miles traveled. So that is really for dense areas, mainly Minneapolis-St. Paul, Rochester, Duluth, where people can make a different choice. They can choose transit, they can choose something else that they could do. Light blue is where we can switch over to a different fueled vehicle and where electric will be available. Darker blue is a mix of electric vehicles and where buses might be switching over by 2050. Green is where biofuels will be able to be the replacement. And olive is the elimination of heavy refrigerants over time. And so you can see it's a combination effect of things that are really going to be able to get us there. And I'm sure there's a lot that everyone will want to talk about in that slide. I'm sure we can't do it all today, but there's going to be a lot of things that come out of this discussion for future discussion and hearings. The public outreach, some of the things that we heard, and the longer report has a lot more in it, but the public, Minnesotans told us through this process that there is very strong support for requiring car makers to offer more fuel-efficient vehicles here in Minnesota, and that's what this rulemaking process will result in Minnesota. That funding electric vehicle and biofuel infrastructure across the state. So you see the Tesla stations, but the Tesla stations can only fuel Tesla vehicles. So we need something that is more interoperable to have that so people don't have what is called range anxiety across the state. Funding electric vehicle incentives and requiring multimodal options in community design. A little bit like the transit director was talking about, one of the things that the transit office at MnDOT has undertaken is this regional approach to transit planning across the state so that communities are more connected. There is more planning going on where and this was always amazing to me when I sat on the transportation committee, that the transit stopped at the county boundary. And, you know, we may need the transit system to go across the county boundaries. So these are the things that we saw a lot of support for as we did the outreach. And then what we saw is that there are things that MnDOT can do right now, and there are recommendations that were outside of MnDOT's authority and control, and where other state agencies can take action, or maybe the governor needs to take action. So that's how we look at the report going forward. So actions, finding integrated solutions. So one of the things that we will be doing is having a sustainable transportation advisory council. So you know we have a connected and automated vehicle council that will be reappointed soon that will be focused on connected and automated vehicles. We also want to have a sustainable and transportation advisory council That will be focused on these issues, including the future funding of transportation under a scenario where more electric vehicles and differently fueled vehicles are available. Regional collaboration on electric vehicle corridors, funding electric vehicle infrastructure, clean transportation funding, providing more transportation options on projects, and providing electric vehicle options. The recommendations, and you certainly can read them all, but the governor also recently appointed a biofuels council to work on many of these things, but promoting biofuels to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and supporting rural Minnesota. We know there's work to be done both in the production of biofuels becoming greener and how important it is to rural Minnesota to have clean technology in that area as well. So I'm not going to read all the conclusions because I know I'm going to run out of time, Mr. Chairman, but maybe I should stop there and if anyone has questions right now.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Questions from the committee? Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the 2007 Renewable Energy Act or whatever, at the time there were all these calculations about how many million tons of CO2 in the air. And I still have to wonder, and now that it's coming up again, I mean, will we as a committee, because we're the ones that should know and understand this, will we have the chance to actually hear from whoever, some kind of an expert that has put these numbers together? Who comes up with statewide, this calculation? I mean, it does seem like, we need to know because we're going to be changing this kind of policy in our state dramatically. It shouldn't be based on just somebody's, conception, It should be something real.
Sure. So,
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, I am happy when if you would like to call another hearing or when you're back in session to bring the experts before you. I mean, basically what we've done here is because the law of the Next Generation Energy Act applies to all, we've applied this to the transportation sector, which we believe it applies to in the law. We have gone out and modeled what is happening in greenhouse gases in Minnesota, and we could bring our experts in who have done that.
Mr. Chair, I think that would be very
Runbeck.
Helpful.
Yeah, I concur, Representative Runbeck, and I think again, in a future hearing, we should, I think, take a look at the modeling for this and other reports, and also, if there's some specific numerical goals that we have in terms of how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from the transportation sector, those would be helpful. But I do think, Representative Runbeck, that's a good suggestion, and we'll work on that again in the near future, probably if we do it, we don't do it in the interim, early in the session. Representative Kosnick. Representative Hausman, then Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just an observation or request, perhaps. I hope we spend at least as much time as we are talking about single-occupancy electric vehicles, which still need roads and bridges, as we do on public mass transit and intercity passenger rail, where we're moving masses of people in some corridors, that I hope we don't forget that efficiency piece. So that's my one concern about the popular new subject.
Thank you.
Representative Hausman, I would agree. There was a editorial recently on that I'll share with you and other members of the committee in the San Francisco newspaper, actually, which talked about this very issue and that, one of the best, and you touched on it too, Commissioner, about, driving less is sometimes we overlook that and the role of land use planning in reducing carbon emissions. The U of M did a study in 2009 and in addition to transit and energy efficient vehicles came up with that as a very important way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in transportation. Representative Kosnick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good to see you again, Commissioner. It's been like a couple times in the last couple of weeks that we've seen each other. In reference to the electric vehicle, slide 12 or so, the fund electric vehicle enhancements on the infrastructure was one of the actions that you recommended. Could you share a little bit about kind of standardizing charging systems for the presumed popular, the presumed electric vehicle that are coming here? And you'd mentioned, you know, Tesla charges on a different system and that, and you know, I guess I would have some concerns from a state perspective of how we're deciding which charging systems to do, and you know, maybe let the market kind of figure it out first, and then it'd probably be a more appropriate discussion for state investments, if any at all.
Good question.
So,
thank you,
yeah,
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kosnick, I think it's a great question. And actually, Department of Commerce and the PCA have been doing some work on this with the Volkswagen settlement. So I think this is where we need to do some cross-sector work, because it's not only the Department of Transportation working on this issue, and it's why we have been trying to work across with our other agencies on the issues of planning and not only thinking about not just choosing, but I think I use it as an example with Tesla, because Tesla has made a huge investment in their technology, but it's proprietary technology. And it's built right into the price of that vehicle. When you buy that vehicle, you have a guarantee that you're going to be able to fuel that vehicle as you travel across the country. The challenge is, if you buy a Chevy Bolt right now, you may not have that same guarantee to be able to make it across the country in the same sort of way. And so I think it is a question. Is it our job to do that, or is it someone else's job to do that? We need to have that discussion. It's a great discussion for policymakers to be having right now.
Thank you. I appreciate the comments.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick. I very much concur with your line of questioning here. So we'll take one more question from Representative Elkins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So another question I've been exploring, and I hope we can get an answer to, is that I was one of several people, had a tour with Xcel Energy recently.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And a question that I posed to them, and they couldn't answer on the spot, but they said that they could derive that answer, is that the question of what percentage of the energy that you're using to charge your electric vehicle is actually clean energy as well. And the rough answer I got was that if you're charging your car in the small hours of the evening, the vast majority of the energy that's being used to charge your car is either nuclear or wind, which is to say CO2-free. Mm-hmm. But they did promise me that they would be able to quantify it. They said it does vary somewhat by season, but I think that's a big part of the answer as well.
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Elkins, it's actually why I think when I came to the department, one of the things I wanted to separate out is the Connect and Automated Vehicle Task Force from the Sustainable Transportation Advisory Council, because I think that people sometimes get a little confused between connected and automated vehicles. Connected and automated vehicles can have a combustion engine, no doubt about it. Some of you are driving Level 2 and Level 3 connected vehicles today. But an electric vehicle, if you're driving one, is very different in terms of it may have a connected feature to it. But we can answer some of those questions in that advisory council or task force. And so we're going to get that formed up here, and that is some of those key questions that we can then start producing reports on and get to the bottom of.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner, so much, and we look forward to our continued work with you.
Well, and thank you. And I'm just happy to have gotten to come to Winona and see some of these great projects out here. And I always think it's really beneficial when we can see things around this.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We appreciated your joining us for part of the tour this morning.
Thanks.
As well. So, members, we're going to have one final presentation from a state agency, and we're very happy to have the Commissioner of Public Safety with us, Commissioner Harrington, So it's been a very busy summer as it relates to the Department of Public Safety. So as the members know, we have oversight over this department, particularly in its transportation functions. The State Patrol is part of our oversight responsibilities. Also driver and vehicle services. And so there are a couple of issues that we have been very attentive to in this committee on a bipartisan basis, and I want to thank again Representative Torkelson for his efforts on vehicle license registration system, our new system that we've transitioned to. So we're going to hear about that. There's been an update. We're making a transition from the old MNLAR system to the new VTRS system. I'm not even going to try to pronounce that. I'll get in trouble. So we're going to hear about that. A contract was signed with FAST Systems, so we'll hear about that. I asked the department to give us a response. I've had members from both sides of the aisle contact me in recent months. This has been an ongoing issue with families who are trying to get driver's exams for their kids. Some in the Twin Cities have talked to me about traveling as far as Albert Lea to get this, and we wanted to find out from the department any response they have to that problem and how they're working to solve that. And then finally, it caught my attention, the Winona Daily News had an article again about these extreme weather events, and I learned in this article from just a couple weeks ago and from the Daily News that the Department of Public Safety through the Homeland HSEM was involved in the disaster response here in terms of getting money out to the communities, and I wanted the department to discuss a little how that process is going and how that works when there is a natural disaster of this kind and Homeland Security and emergency management is involved. We had, I think, a question about that earlier today, how that money gets to local communities. So those are the three items we have on the agenda for you, Commissioner Harrington, and again, appreciate so much that you've come from the Twin Cities down here to be with us and answer questions and give a presentation. So welcome back to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Harrington. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. And it was a beautiful drive down, and as per my governor's orders, that when he talks about One Minnesota, he means that we, as his commissioners, will see all of Minnesota. And I think I'm on 36 counties currently and working toward the whole 87 before we're done. So, thank you very much for the opportunity to talk. Starting in January of 2019, the Department of Public Safety had really three priorities for our driver and vehicle services. Number one, fix MNLARs. And for most of the first part of the session, that was it was MNLARs in the morning, it was MNLARs in the afternoon, occasionally it was MNLARs late into the night, but it was MNLARs constantly. Our second priority was preparing for Real ID, which if you haven't seen the commercials, you will. October of 2020, you have to have your Real ID if you want to fly. And then the third we had was to address what we saw as a coming backlog for driver's license testing. The deputy registrars, the community, the legislature, and the governor's office made it very, very clear to me from the very earliest top fight that fixing MNLARs was the number one priority. And so starting in January, we began working on deficiency funding. We got the deficiency funding. We were able to hire some temporary staff so that we could start working on the backlog, because there were literally cases stacked above desk level, above cubicle level, that were old titles that were in the paper form that we were trying to get caught up. That backlog was literally months long, and we have through some judicious use of part-time staff and new staff and some new technology, really pretty much caught that up. We worked with Minute to prepare for two releases. Number one, fix the specialty plate issue. Fairbolt 1 comes flashing into mind whenever I think about specialty plates. But there were literally hundreds of other deficiencies that the DRs had that they said needed to be fixed, and so between release 1 and 2, we've managed to fix most of those. We have worked with the DRs and the auto dealers And because we were granted that funding by May, we were actually able to hire some temps, and we were actually starting to work on the backlog. Hiring the temps has been a challenge, I will admit to that. That is part of our struggle here. So we hired temps to work on the backlog. So you train the temps, which took the really experienced people off of the line. They trained the temps. The temps got just about good enough, and then about that time, you would move the experienced people back into working on the really thorny issues in there. And then we'd have a new system that needed to come online. And one of the lessons we learned from the 2017 launch is that if you do not do regression testing, you will fail. So we pull the really experienced people off of the line, send them back now down to make sure that we're doing regression testing so that when the system does actually get launched, it doesn't have any failures. And we have had every launch and every release has been perfect because of that. That has put a strain on our ability to keep up with some of the work, but we, I think, are keeping moving with that. At the same time, we're also working with BAS on getting phase two of the DL system up and running. Phase one started in the fall of 18, and so what we recognized is if we didn't get phase two done in a timely fashion, we wouldn't be ready for a window of opportunity. Part of having Real ID is being part of a compact where you can check driver's license from state to state to make sure that someone that has a driver's license in Arizona doesn't also have a driver's license in Minnesota. And there's a window of time when we were allotted to be able to get into the state-to-state system to look at that. And if we did not have our computer system up and running by July of this year, we would have missed that window. And so we worked with FAST, once again, moving bodies around to make sure that we were ready for July, and we were ready by July. In August, we started our state-to-state work. By September, we are largely, I can call that a success, and we're ready for Real ID. This was funded, as I said, by July, we were pretty much done with that. Once Minlar's deficiency funding was done and we got those first two fixes, we were pivoted. So initially it was just fix the Real ID, fix the specialty plates, and then it was, well, now we really need to do something really substantial about Minlar's. So the conversation led by Rick King and the Blue Ribbon Panel, legislature, the governor's office, and my staff all said, well, what would the recommendation be? The recommendation was to drop Minlar's and pivot to a third-party option, which some call it meters. I've heard many of the deputy register refer to that as a curable disease, and so we're at this point, we're looking for the next great name for this system. And if any of you have suggestions, we are open to that conversation. So, FAS has... We began the process with Department of Admin to do the RFP, got the RFP started, got our first responsive vendor, did the background that needed to be done on that, negotiated a contract that actually came in a little lower than we thought it was going to come in, and that was awarded the contract. The timeline that the legislature had given us was we were supposed to have that done by July, and we had it done by July. Something I was told by many very experienced state hands that this was not something... Negotiating a $30 million contract for this big a system was not supposed to be able to be done in that time frame, but I've got great staff that doesn't really understand that you can't get stuff done. So thanks to all of that work and Rick King, we have our contract in place. And because we were prepared for this, by the time that contract was signed, we had offices ready for the FAST people. We had computers. We were ready for them, and FAST had people on the ground in July. In fact, they are so well advanced at this point that we went to the Deputy Register's annual convention in St. Cloud. They were able to show a demo of what the new VEDERS, whatever that name is going to be, system will look like. And we got a great reaction from the Deputy Register's that this system was scanning and a much more robust system that they are part and parcel of building is exactly what they were looking for and what they were hoping for, and the training plan is ready to go. So VEDERS and Minlar's. Minlar's is now being decommissioned. VEDERS is still being developed. We have a timeline for that. All of those things seem to be working pretty well as we went along there. The next piece of this really then was to go back and look at that whole issue. I said we had three issues. Real ID was ready to go. Menlars and Peters were ready to go. And then it was the driver's license piece that we started looking at. Part of that solution was bringing on some fresh eyes to see that. We brought on Assistant Commissioner Tim Lytle, who had been my business manager when I was at Metro Transit. And we also brought in Emma Corey, who now runs the Department of Vehicle Services. We wanted a fresh set of eyes as to not just titles and reg and licensing, but the whole product. Because of that, we've come up with three fixes for driver's license. And we actually went back and did our own historical data dump for it. First thing we noted in that is that there is a peak. There's a surge of when driver's license applications lag the most. And I don't think I'd be very surprised to anybody in this room, that's during the summer. It starts in May. We go from about 20 days out to get a driver's license test in April. By May, it's 50 days. By June, it's 60 days. In July, it's 55 days. And then as we get to the state fair, it drops back down to about 25 days. And then it begins to go back to a normalized level of about 20 days from that point on. That matched the anecdotal stories we had from people that had called us. We got the same calls probably, maybe some of the same people called, that said, my son or daughter or child wanted to take the driver's test, and so in May we started to look for a driver's test, and we were told that, well, we could probably get one in late August if we went to Duluth or Albert Lea. Duluth is actually, I think, more popular even than Albert Lea was in terms of being able to get people tested. That didn't make any sense. And so we began looking at, well, why do we have this backlog? And there were a couple of different areas that we felt that, number one, we could start to fix. The first area was a technological fix. Quite simply, we had a very cumbersome system for trying to find where you could get the test. And so we had Minute work with us to say, could you build us a button that says, find the next available test? Rather than you having to go from the Albert Lea station to the Duluth station to the Apple Valley station to the, you know, and go each station individually looking for a test, just push the button and find the next available test. It doesn't actually speed up the testing process, but it does make the people that are trying to find the test feel a little bit better about the fact that they're not spending hours at a computer trying to negotiate a state system to find a test. But the second piece actually has really already reduced the backlog. The second part of this, is once again, came out of some anecdotal conversations. So you want to have your son or daughter take the test. You're relatively comfortable that they're going to be good at this, but you want to have a plan B. So what do? You sign up for the test at Arden Hills for a date certain, and then you sign up for a test at Albert Lea and in Winona and Duluth as a backup plan, because just in case they fail the test, do you really want to wait 60 days from when they fail the test to get the next bite of the apple? The system we had set up allowed you to do that. You could sign up for as many spots as you wanted, which doesn't make a lot of sense. But it also did not eliminate those spots if you passed the test. So what we've now done is we have reworked the system so that you take the test in Albert Lea. You pass the test on the first time. The system then goes through and automatically deletes all of the other tests that you had signed up for. Now, that might not sound like a lot, but the first time we ran that program, it eliminated 300 tests that would have been a no-show. We estimate that this will free up 26,000 road tests over the course of a year. So that should help us reduce that backlog substantially. It won't necessarily reduce the backlog in the summer, but overall, it should cut down the backlog, because quite literally, in talking to the folks at the testing stations, they have a list of 40 people that show up on a day that are walk-ins. They have all the list of people that are supposedly signed up, and when there's a ton of those people that are no-shows, only a fraction of the people that waited all day. The last person I talked to says they got there at 5 o'clock in the morning and they were number 35 on the list. They spent the day there, and that doesn't make any sense. Nor does the idea that when another person that called me said, well, they could get the test, but it was Duluth during school on a work day. So their kid would miss a day of school, they would miss a day of work to get to Duluth to do the test. That doesn't make good sense. That's not good customer service. So in order to remedy that, we've come up with two other solutions, one that is going to go into effect in November, the other will go into effect next summer. The November fix is quickly simply this. If you're going to be responsive to the community you serve, which is kind of the model that I've lived by as a cop, what hours would you be open for testing?
Early evening,
weekend. You'd be open in the evening, and we close at 4:30 most days. That doesn't really make much sense. So starting November 1st, we're going to keep driver's license testing stations open until 7, so that when you get out of school at 3, there's now a 3.5-hour block. It will give us an additional 18 hours a week because we're also going to be open consistently on Saturdays. That will free up 18 hours per week per station for additional tests. And we think that will help, in addition to eliminating the 26,000 no-shows, that will also allow us to make sure that we're more responsive on our testing. The third piece of this is a pilot that we plan to run next summer. So once again, the data shows us the majority of the backlog is during the summer. I've got staff that wants to take the summer off like everybody else does, that's when I've got the backlog, so they can't take the summer off. And I don't have enough people to fill all of the spots that I have. Who else has got the summer off, though?
College kids.
College kids and?
Teachers.
And teachers. If we recruited a seasonal and created a seasonal driver's testing set that could be hired from those two populations, we could fill all of our work during the summer and, in fact, fill more work than we needed, allowing our regular staff to take some time off during the summer, but not negatively impacting any of the folks that want to have tests. We believe that that will be up and running and ready by the summer of 2020. And so between those three remedies, we believe that we will have a much better story to tell you next summer when we come back to talk about where is the backlog and where is where are we at on that. I will note that I think we have had some successes. I look back at when I first got here. The lag time for titles when I first got here was 81 days. The time now average for titles is 26 days. Driver's licenses are all coming out between 37 and 40 days, and we expect, and actually it is our goal that we stated, is to have all driver's licenses out in people's hands in 30 days or less, and we believe we can get that to substantially less than that. The last item that you asked me to talk about was, in fact, the disaster recovery. And once again, it's the story of two different seasons. When I got to the legislature, got to this office, it was snow and we were rescuing people from highways all over the place. And then we were having power lines that were dropping because of ice. And then that water melted and became bigger water, and now the rain doesn't ever want to seem to stop. And so we have continued to have more and more disasters there. Make sure I get my numbers right. So since April, we've had 13 major disasters. There have been three presidential federal disasters. Presidential disasters are different than state disasters in that the federal government pays for 75% of the disaster and the state has to come up with the other 25%. With state disasters, we pay the entire amount. There have been 10 federal disasters declared. We've responded to and designated state or federal disaster aid to 118 different local municipalities. And 8 tribal nations since in this calendar year. The total damage to public infrastructure from all of those disasters, most of which are water related, has been $90 million. The federal government is on the hook for the majority of that, but we have still about $30 million that we believe will be let out from state funds to county and townships. These are primarily related to roads, and from what we've been told by the local emergency managers, it is roads and bridges that have taken the biggest beating. Although we have also heard from them that says the water systems, the sewage systems, were never designed for this volume of water, and so they are operating beyond peak capacity. As I said, bridges and roads are the single largest category of damage from the natural disasters, and we are told that by several experts that they have never seen the infrastructure that is supposed to handle the water in worse condition. And many of those folks we talked to have been doing this for 30 years. We have a number of key multi-agency partnerships. Many of them are really starting to talk about mitigation as much as we're talking about disaster response. So there's the rebuilding of it, but there's also the issue of how do we build so that the next time it floods, we don't have as big a disaster. And what we're seeing from that is that while there are increasing federal dollars to support mitigation, the state doesn't normally provide the match. And that means that local municipalities then have to, or the counties have to provide that 25% match. And that is a challenge that most of them are saying they cannot match that dollar for dollar. And so they look to the state for relief, and the dollars that we got through deficiency and through our regular legislative process, which are for the response to these major disasters, are frankly tied up, and the Department of Public Safety out of HSEM does not have the funds currently to be able to support these mitigation efforts. And so we are having that conversation with our local partners to say, we are going to have to work with you to try and find other resources to do the mitigation, because if we don't do the mitigation, what we know will happen is the same tragedies that have happened this time will happen again, because the flooding is not stopping, and it is the water continues to come. That, in short, is my response to
thank
the questions
you.
That you asked.
Yes, thank you.
Over time, and I apologize.
We had a big assignment for you, so I, again, appreciate your testimony and appreciate what a wonderful partner you've been to this committee and your tenure so far as commissioner. So, members, I just wanted to we have a couple questions. I want those to be brief and the answers to be brief, because we have two bills we want to hear and we want to get the public testimony and end on time. And Representative Hausman does have a time constraint because she has another committee to go to. So I'm going to ask Representative Nelson to keep his question brief and Representative Elkins to keep his question brief and the responses, and then we'll be able to move on in our agenda. Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Commissioner.
And Representative Cosner.
The question I had, and you touched on some of that as you were going on with the driver's license and vehicle, the face of the driver's license testing, is the increase in capacity. It seems like, are we tracking where that is, and it doesn't make sense to find a way to build another or create another testing area, even a temporary one during the summer that can help take some of that capacity. In my mind, it doesn't seem like we have any more tests. When I took my test 50 years ago, or my sons took their test 30 years ago, and some of those same places are there, I think the population in our state has increased dramatically since that time. And I guess you touched on some of that, creating a way to increase the capacity by adding staff, temporary staff in the summer, and slightly in the hours. But have we looked at that as a way of possibly finding, mapping it out on where the biggest backlog is, and finding a way to increase capacity by maybe adding another testing site?
Commissioner Harrington.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the answer is yes. We've looked in a variety of places. Part of this is looking at where the demographics are telling us we have large cohorts of young people that are driving, so that we can, in fact, place driver's license testing stations there. One of the places we've looked at, for example, is in North Minneapolis. There is a large cohort of young people from a wide variety, and there is no real close testing center there. In this case, it would probably mean we would have been doing a road test on city streets. As many of us did, that's how I took my test on the south side of Chicago. It was probably maybe a little more challenging back in those days. So yes, we are looking at that, but we also recognize that we have facilities that are underutilized. We have facilities that are only operating during the morning, and so frankly, getting enough staff to operate them for their full complement. We've already built the infrastructure. I think we should try and make sure we use that infrastructure first before we build anything substantially new.
Thank you. Representative Elkins.
Real quick, anecdotally, We have colleagues who have gotten their real ID in like 2 weeks, who have a top secret security clearances, and other colleagues who have waited 2 months who don't have top secret security clearances. Do we know how much of the delay is in the handoff from, you know, DVS takes all the information, it has to be shipped off to Washington, D.C. for the federal background checks and then comes back. Do we know how much of the delay is the feds doing their thing as opposed to anything that you have under your control?
Commissioner Harrington.
I don't think this is the, I'm not going to blame the federal government on this. What I think is more likely to have happened is as I move staff from driver's license to titles or move them to regression testing, the number of staff that we're processing has come and gone. And we see our rise and fall more related to our staff and of the centers than we think it has anything to do with the background checks in terms of getting that contact with the feds.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kosnick, for our last question.
Thank you, and I will try not to ask a question during the other bills, but I do think this is a very important, extremely important topic, so I appreciate the time of the committee. Commissioner, thanks for being here. I didn't know that you were going to be speaking on the driver's exams things. This is an issue that I've heard about in my community with a lot of young families, growing high schools, so it's been very forefront of some of the work that I've been doing this summer. I think your suggestion or in November extending the hours is incredibly customer service orientated, and I think the public will appreciate that. So thank you for doing something that's just maybe more common sense. And so I think that's some of the things that you mentioned in the summer hours and stuff I think is very helpful. A lot of the places that I talk to have labor shortages, so your suggestion of trying to have teachers, I think it's outside the box. I'm not sure how many teachers want to kind of do that, but it's a good attempt, so good luck on that one. But I was hoping that you could comment on two things. One was my understanding is that the current law is that you should be able to schedule a driver's exam test within 14 days either in your county of residence or the neighboring county, if I understood it correctly. I'm not sure if you're prepared to comment on that, but if you are, I'd be curious. And there's, some ramifications that's the standard that was set previously that we should be trying to meet. And then further, in doing some of the work that I've looked at into this issue, if you'd be able to comment today about certain driving schools have standing test times reserved for them at these training centers. And so if you are a mom or a dad trying to take your son or daughter to get tested, the driving test done, you have to kind of know the system and be willing to pay maybe a little bit more in many cases, an extra $100 or something to these certain schools to kind of jump in front of the line. If you could comment on that, if you think that's a practice that should continue, if that's something we should do away with. And then the whole practice of having certain preferred schools have that ability and other schools don't, and how they get on that preferred list. I'm concerned that there may be schools that are charging extra to have these predetermined times that they've been given for free on a preferred status, that they're marking up a state resource and profiting off that. I think that's something that I'd like to hear your comments and something that I'd like to work on going into next session.
Commissioner Harrington.
I've heard the 14-day rule more as a guideline than it has been a state law, and so I'm going to have to do some more checking on that to be able to get you a much more satisfactory.
We'll let Mr. Burris look into that.
Okay.
On the second piece,
not right now.
On your second question about the driver's license schools or the driver training schools, we have seen that. We've had conversations. We are preparing at this point to have a conversation with that industry or that group of schools to say, we believe that does not make sense to us, that everyone should have a fair and equal chance at getting a driver's test. And so we are prepared to have that conversation with them. We expect there will be some pushback from the schools that have had a preferred situation where they got the first pick of for those driving testing dates. But we believe that a more equitable system needs to be worked out. And we would welcome your input and suggestions as to how we get to that equitable piece, because it does appear that not only are parents cut out, but even some of the other driving schools have called us to say that they are also cut out of being able to get any spots.
And Representative Kozak, if you have one quick follow-up, and then I have a suggestion, then we'll move on to Representative Hausman's bill.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the comments. Sitting next, the privilege of sitting next to the House research is that he can whisper in your ear. Apparently, the 14-day is in statute, and so that's something that we'll obviously need to work together on to meet that. And then I appreciate the commissioner's comments today and being prepared to discuss this. And we'll do some work, and I look forward to working with you.
I look forward to working with you on both of those sites.
And then thank you, and Representative Kozak, thanks.
And Lakeville would be a great site for an testing site. I can work with you on
I
that,
I see
too.
A bill coming.
Representative, back there taking copious notes. So.
But and thank you for your thoughtful responses, and clearly there is more work to do. And I guess what I would propose, you know, and Representative Kozak, you've raised questions that, again, you know, people are calling me colleagues on both sides of the aisle, as I mentioned, and you know, maybe we might want to convene, or I would be happy to convene some sort of an informal working group before session for us to bat around some ideas, you know, along with the department and others. You know, clearly the parents, I think we want to engage with the parents who've been calling us and figure out you know, a way to address this question in the next session, because it's important, it's urgent. I think we're making progress, but you know, maybe we should have a little, you know, conversation about that. So thank you, members, and thank you, Commissioner Harrington. And now we'll transition to a couple of bills that we're going to hear. So for those members of the public, what you'll see now, we're not going to vote on these bills, but we are going to have a hearing, as we would in St. Paul, what we would call an informational hearing. And so a couple members of the committee have bills that I think are of very specific interest to this part of the state, as well as statewide import. And the first bill we're going to hear, and so what we do is we typically have the member briefly present the bill to the committee, and then the committee has a chance to interact with the author with some questions, and then we have witnesses, members of the public, or those that have an interest in the bill speak for or against the legislation, then we move on. So the first, we're going to have, each member has two related bills. Representative Torkelson will be next after Representative Hausman. But we'll first hear Representative Hausman's House File 1804, and I guess 1493 is similar. And the members have the choice of either presenting the bill where they're sitting, or they can go to the testifiers table, and Representative Hausman, as a member of the committee, has opted to just stay where she is. And Representative Hausman, I will move House Files 18.
We're not moving them,
not even for to lay them over. Okay, so this is just for information purposes only, and we will hear again House Files 1804 and 1493 that were both introduced last February.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's a reason I'm staying here, because normally, if I were presenting a bill, I would be speaking to members, hoping to engage them in the bill and get them to support my bill. Today, because we're here, the far more important conversation that we're having is our speaking to the community about this. And in this case, because I know the bills I'm presenting, there is huge local support for it. And so I'm going to speak very little, because we have good testifiers from the communities that we're visiting who will speak to their support of this and why. So really, in these two bills, there are three ideas. In one bill, we just fund the second train to Chicago. Today, we got a very good example of what one problem we'd solve if we did that. We visited the depot, and the passengers were sitting there waiting. I don't know how long they had been waiting, and they still had to wait longer because the Empire Builder would be coming from the West Coast, where there has been a lot of snow in Montana and Wyoming. And so there is given that long trip and weather delays, they were waiting. If there were a second train a day that just went from the Twin Cities to Chicago, they wouldn't be affected by that. And interestingly, as we were having the presentation, and Derek James from Amtrak was talking about this, one of the couples came up to me after that was waiting. And, I mean, they were just quite intrigued by this because clearly they make this trip from the Twin Cities or from Winona to Chicago with some frequency. And it suddenly occurred to them this would be a really good deal. And so local, I know we have some local people who will speak to the strong support about this second train to Chicago and its importance. In the other bill, we do two things. One, we fund, we provide funding for the department to move forward on the entire state rail plan. There is a state rail plan that's developed, that's been developed by MnDOT. A good bit of work has gone into this. This would fund a variety of corridors that are all at different stages. The Northern Lights Express between the Twin Cities and Duluth, additional Amtrak service from the Twin Cities to Chicago, and then, Representative Wolgamott, the extension of North Star Commuter Rail to St. Cloud. A long time ago, we started that corridor, and Representative Wolgamott was successful this year in getting some cash to continue the study. That has been driven by local support. Their mayor, their Chamber of Commerce, the city all understood the importance of getting that extension to North Star to St. Cloud, and he was successful. He was successful because of local support, and that's why I'm delighted that we're here today and that Red Wing and Winona will speak to us about similar local support. I think Northfield is also in the room today. At least I heard that some people might be representing Susie, who couldn't be here. There's a part of that second bill where we provide $500,000 from the general fund for study and alternatives from rail service. The ones that have been driving that have been primarily Northfield, but I know all of Board Minnesota believes that a train to the south has some real promise. For those of you in Northfield, I would invite you to contact newly elected Jeff Brand from St. Peter because I just spoke to him last night, and he has a good bit of interest in connecting his part of southern Minnesota as well. So I do believe that just as Representative Wolgamott recognized that local support is essential, Red Wing and Winona will provide that today. And I'm not sure if Northfield is speaking, but at any rate, I think there's reason to hope that there will be additional support there. All of Board Minnesota has done an economic study of the importance of intercity passenger rail to their state and their region. I'm not comparing us to California or New York. I'm comparing us to the Midwestern states like Texas and Kansas, all of whom are understanding the economic impact of intercity passenger rail to their area. They are all happily accepting federal money and federal partnerships to do that. In this case, believe it or not, Minnesota is trailing everybody. You know, people are passing us by, all of our Midwest economic competitors. And so this is, I've been carrying these bills for a few years. I am hoping that local support from this region will light a fire as you contact the governor, as you contact your local legislators to bring this message to bear. And I think, Mr. Chair, I won't say much more than that right now just because I know we have good testimony and maybe we'll wrap up after.
Sure. Well, thank you. Are there any questions from members of the committee to Chair Hausman? Okay, well, with that, I do have some people that called us ahead of time to testify. First will be Mr. Paul Schulmeier. He's a member of the Winona City Council. He's also a member of the Great River Rail Commission. And I want to also thank Councilmember Schulmeier also for joining us this morning at the depot. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. Paul Schulmeier. I'm a resident here of Winona, and I'm a council member here for the city, and I am on the Great River Rail Commission. I have a written statement, and I'll read through that. I want to provide time for my constituents to speak here today. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Like I said, earlier. My name is Paul Schulmeier. I am on the City Council here in Winona and on the Great River Rail Commission. We will be meeting on November 7th in Red Wing at the County Office Building. You're very welcome to attend. I want to extend my warm and dry welcome to you all, to our community, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about issues related to transportation in our great city. I'll be brief. I'll allow time for other constituents to speak. There are numerous issues which rise to the level of concern for my constituents. Among them, EV infrastructure, regional workforce, transportation, bicycle safe routes, roads and bridges, alternative transportation, especially the inner city passenger rail service. But my focus here today will be rail transportation, and specifically funding for the final design, administration, and construction of the Minnesota part of the Twin Cities Chicago-Milwaukee, also known as the TCMC, or more simply, the second train. Currently, Winona, St. Paul, and Red Wing are the only active rail stations in the state that receive daily passenger rail. That hasn't deterred 123,000 passengers riding the current Empire Builder, nor the 41% of Winona State University students who said they have used Amtrak in the past, 41% of 7,000 students. Unfortunately, in Minnesota, they only get a single eastbound and westbound train each day. One option daily. Oftentimes, the eastbound train is delayed, as Representative Hausman mentioned earlier. This is far too little passenger rail for a state that leads the Midwest in so many aspects of business and tourism. Fortunately, a plan is in the works that would bring a second train to these communities, adding 155,000 passenger trips annually between Chicago and St. Paul, 70% of which, I have heard, do not get off in St. Paul or Chicago, but disembark in rural communities such as Winona. Without the unintended delays from weather and crowded rail lines in the Dakotas or Montana. A second train would create jobs and generate economic growth in our community, as some of Amtrak's contractors are right here in this city. A second train would decrease the amount of automobile traffic on highly subsidized interstate highways. A second train would provide a safe, reliable, relaxing, productive, and affordable alternative to driving or flying. It would also add alternatives for a large college population while simultaneously reducing issues related to student automobile parking right here in our city. A second train would conveniently arrive at 4 to 6 hour differential from the current Empire Builder, creating arrival and departures in Minnesota that better fit a business traveler's schedule. It would provide access to tourism, outdoor recreation, and to our ever-expanding cultural arts calendar, a more than $100 million economic impact in our community. Finally, improvements to siding in Minnesota and Wisconsin will enhance the flow of freight rail within the corridor, a resource important to all Minnesotans. To make the second train possible, improvements are needed along the rail corridor in Minnesota, specifically at the Mississippi River crossing near La Crescent, at the CK Tower siding in Winona, and, as previously mentioned and as you toured earlier, the platform in Winona. Mr. Chairman, earlier this year, the Winona City Council unanimously passed a resolution supporting the TCMC, unanimously. Without reservations, we ask that your committee and the Minnesota House adopt and pass the MnDOT request for $10 million in matching funds to a future federal grant for the final design and construction of track, signal, and siding improvements in Minnesota. The city of Winona and 155,000 future passengers are eager for your support, as are the other river communities that stand ready to welcome them. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Councilmember Schulmeier. Any members have questions of the council member? Okay, thank you. Representative Runbeck, sure. Sorry about that, Representative Runbeck.
So, Mr. Schulmeier, I think this morning we were told that the cost is something like $31 million total for the upgrades that you're looking at. Is that not the...
I believe that's correct. Okay. It's approximately, in Minnesota, about $31 million.
Correct. And is that the extent of what you're looking at, or is that just the first piece of a rollout that's going to continue?
So that's a very detailed question. To the best of my understanding, that $31 million, and there are MnDOT officials here that could correct me, to the best of my understanding, that $31 million would pay for the construction of the side rails at the river crossing, the platform in Winona, and the side rail at the tower crossing.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, it does seem like that in reading the information here that there's perhaps more expansion that would occur after this. So I'm just curious about that. And does Winona have a sense of what dollars they might be involved in providing? Is there any sort of real number you're looking at?
I have no dollar figures that the city would be pitching in as far as contributions toward this.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rumbrick. And again, thank you, Council Member. Our next testifier is Sean Dowse, the mayor of Red Wing, and also a member of the Great River Rail Commission. If I didn't pronounce your last name correctly, I apologize. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Sean Dowse, and I'm proud to be the mayor of Red Wing, Minnesota. It's great to be here, and I appreciate you coming down and this opportunity to testify for you. I'm here to support Representative Kausman's bill, also the $10 million for the Twin City, Milwaukee-Chicago second train. At present, mostly sold-out trains arrive in Red Wing twice a day, and folks can embark on trips both east and west and points east and west throughout the country, and visitors can disembark in Red Wing and travel just one block from the station to our historic downtown and hotel and entertainment district. Tourism is a several million-dollar industry in Red Wing as part of our economy. We attract visitors from Minnesota, Wisconsin, and all over the country. The increase in ANPAC trips that would be provided by the second train would provide a safe, reliable travel alternative to Red Wing and our region, and a more convenient schedule of round trips, as Mr. Schulmeier talked about. I really believe that would foster day trips to and from Red Wing, from points north and south, as well as become encourage trips for work in Red Wing, going to the Twin Cities and points south. You have before you, I think, a resolution that the City Council passed, as Mr. Schulmeier says, unanimously. They're noting that the TCMC will offer faster and more reliable travel times and will provide a more attractive and affordable transportation option. Minnesota Department of Transportation has already led a study to evaluate service schedules and develop conceptual engineering and cost estimates. For track and signal improvements in Minnesota and Wisconsin to accommodate the second passenger train. The work was done in 2018 with funding from the Wisconsin Department of Transportation, Ramsey County, and La Crosse Area Planning Committee. No funding was provided by Minnesota for this. So funding for Minnesota is needed now to provide a statement for future federal grant to complete the final design.
Red Wing is a regional center for manufacturing, retail, arts, culture, and tourism. In fact, we are a destination for visitors. Just to let you know that there are riverboats on the Mississippi that travel north and south with visitors, and that those travel opportunities are slated to double and triple over the coming years. And Red Wing is the northernmost part of that reach of these travel companies. So we're going to be seeing a huge increase in tourism from riverboats, and I think the opportunity, I think the rail should be a part of this regional growth, and that will benefit the entire state of Minnesota. So thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Dowse. We have one more testifier, but Representative.
Oh, we just have one more?
Yeah,
oh,
at least one more, but okay. I know of one more.
Can we do one more? Okay, I should explain, I am also I chair the Housing Committee in the Minnesota House of Representatives. At another location, we're doing housing. So I just happen to have two of my issue areas up at the same time, but if I could listen to one.
Sure. We have, thank you, Mayor. I appreciate your work, and we have a copy of the resolutions. Brian Nelson from All Aboard Minnesota. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee. I'm Brian Nelson, president of All Aboard Minnesota, which is a nonprofit citizen advocacy group to promote more passenger rail service within the state of Minnesota and to connect us to the upper Midwest. We are very strongly supportive of Representative Hausman's bill to not only fund the second train, but to fund the MnDOT State Rail Plan. It is our belief that the second train out of all of the routes proposed within the MnDOT State Rail Plan offers the greatest propensity for success, mainly because of two factors. One is its relatively low cost to implement the service, and also its projected ridership. As Representative Hausman indicated, we did commission a economic and mobility benefit study for the state around the second train that was published last year. That study is available to you, and we have summarized that for you in a one-sheet overview, which I believe might be included in your packets. But I think one of the things that would be very interesting based off the theme of this particular hearing, one of the conclusions of the study is that the second train alone from Twin Cities to Chicago would take an estimated 90,000 riders out of cars. What that means for the state is that it would reduce car miles by 15 million in that corridor. And what that translates into economically is a $32 million reduction in highway maintenance costs. So I think there is a real economic and mobility benefit that additional rail passenger service can offer. And because passenger trains are three times more efficient than light vehicles, there would be a significant reduction in greenhouse gases. So we believe so strongly in the second train that it is our platform that we want the second train extended from St. Paul to Fargo. We're currently modeling out what the economic ROI and mobility benefits would be in that corridor. We will be presenting those findings on October 30th in Moorhead in a public forum. One final note, the United Transportation Union conducted a survey this March about statewide support for more passenger rail and found that 65% of Minnesotans do support a second train from the Twin Cities to Chicago, and 73% of Minnesotans support more regional rail service in the state, like, for example, service from the St. Paul area to Fargo, the Twin Cities to Duluth, Twin Cities to Des Moines, Kansas City, etc. So there is widespread support within the state for more rail passenger service. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Nelson? Okay. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify for and against the legislation? We'll take these two gentlemen, and then we'll move on to these three folks, and then we'll move on to Representative Torkelson's bill. So if you could please come and state your name for the record. Thank you, Representative Hausman.
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
I would love to hear some more.
I think it will be taped. Right? You can listen to our tape, and that is available for anyone. Available for anyone. Please state your name for the record.
Welcome to Winona, and thank you for coming here to
share with us in this community. My name is Reggie McLeod. I'm editor and publisher of Big River Magazine, and we cover the Mississippi River from the Twin Cities to the Quad Cities, which is 400 miles other than four states. And I wanted to address some concerns. I'm in favor of the second train, but I think there are some issues that should be discussed that would make it more successful. As it's good to see Minnesota catching up with mass transit. The light rails in the Twin Cities are very impressive, and looking at the second train is a really exciting idea. I just wanted to discuss a couple practical matters about using the train. I do a lot of work up in the Twin Cities and go up there for meetings and return, and right now I can't do that on the train because the train goes up to the Twin Cities at 8 o'clock at night and comes back here at 10 in the morning. And if I were having meetings at midnight or 3 o'clock in the morning, it would be useful for me, but now it's not useful at all for that, as much as I'd like to use it. Right now, if the round trip would cost less than $50, if I drive up there and deduct the business expense, it's about $130. So there are huge advantages for business people like me and in Rochester and La Crosse and so on if we could go up there and do business on the train. And you could actually work on the train or sleep on the way back. The other side of it is I grew up in Michigan, and pretty much all of my relatives still live in Michigan, and I used to take the train out there to Detroit and Ann Arbor to visit, and I can't do that anymore because the trains are from the west. The Empire Builder is so late they won't sell me a ticket to Detroit from Winona anymore because I'd probably miss the connection at Chicago. And I've heard that complaint from many people who would like to use Amtrak and can't. So it would be nice to be able to get to Chicago in time to make that connection, and many others. People have difficulty making connections to St. Louis or the East Coast and so on from Chicago. That really undermines the usefulness of Amtrak unless you're just going to Chicago and nowhere else. Also, a lot of people from Winona and La Crosse and the area go up to the Twin Cities to use the airport. And again, getting up to the Twin Cities around midnight doesn't help you with your flights. You almost need two additional trains, if you're going to really make those schedules work. If the schedules don't work, I'm not sure who's going to be using the second train. And that's really of crucial importance. Another thing I think that would be helpful in this, Rochester has been trying to get a zip line up to the Twin Cities, some kind of rail connection. And I think it would be good to look at the possibility of getting a fast rail connection from Rochester to Lake City or Wabasha, which is only about 35 miles, rather than building a whole rail from Rochester up to St. Paul. And of course, if they had that built, they'd want to build another rail from Rochester to La Crosse, and you'd end up dividing this route between St. Paul and Wisconsin into two routes, and they'd probably each have half as much traffic. Whereas if you could get a 35-mile connection from Rochester to the river, and if you look at a map, Lake City and Wabasha, either one of those would be pretty convenient, then that would make the people in Rochester closer to Chicago and to the Twin Cities. It would be pretty convenient, and it would probably add a lot to the traffic on that rail corridor along the Mississippi River at a fraction of the cost of building a rail from Rochester up to the Twin Cities. When I do go to Michigan, it's interesting to note there are three round trips every day between Detroit and Chicago. And the Detroit metropolitan area is about the same size as the Twin Cities metropolitan area. The distance is pretty much the same. And when you have three trains like that running a day, you know, per day, then those are commuter rails. Those are rails that people can use to go to work and do business with regularly because they can depend on them and the trains aren't going across the entire continent, so they're a lot more dependable too. That's a good issue to look at. Between Milwaukee and Chicago, there are 7 trains going each way daily. And if you're looking at the Midwest, that's the Midwest, and I think we could do a lot better than we have been, and it's very exciting for me to see Minnesota taking this step.
Thank you, Mr. McLeod. Are there questions for Mr. McLeod? Okay. I saw a couple of other hands. We're going to take some citizens who have raised their hands first, and I know there's some others that would want to testify, and we'll take them later. But so citizens who are not involved with a special interest group of some kind, we would like to hear from you now. So please, sir and ma'am, and then we'll conclude our testimony on this bill. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Terry Olson. I reside here in Winona, Minnesota, and I'm in favor of the second train, mainly because my business is in Chicago. Most of the month I can work remote from my home, but it does require me making frequent trips to Chicago. And it would be a lot easier to be able to get on a train than it is to drive to Chicago, fighting the traffic, finding a parking spot, which I'm well versed in. I've never driven to work in my whole work career. I've always taken trains and public transportation. And this was a new one on me when we decided to move back up here. To keep on working in Chicago, I have to get in the car and drive all the time. And so I'm very, very much in favor of having a second train, TM. That's my comment. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Mr. Olson. Any questions? Mr. Olson, thank you. Oh, we have Representative Mason has a question for Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious as to why you, if you're doing it on business, why you're using the train maybe rather than a plane.
Mr. Olson.
Well, I look at the Amtrak fares, and they're about half the, most of the time they're about half of what it costs to drive down the road across, get on a plane into Chicago. Plus, I don't mind the 5 or 6 hours that it would be. My vision of it is that the train, the eastbound train, would be departing Winona at about 3:15 in the afternoon going east to Chicago. And I don't mind getting there at 9:15 at night, again, then getting on public transportation to get into our apartment there. It's a lot easier than my experience with airports has been. Delay after delay.
Thank you.
Rail travel is much easier.
Thank you for the question and thank you for your testimony. So, ma'am, if you'd like to...
Can I make one more point? I thank the gentleman for his answer. But the other thing I was going to ask, I know people that do not fly, and so they are looking for additional ways to get to Chicago.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Mason. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. You're here to testify specifically on this bill.
Winona, Minnesota.
I'm sorry, could you repeat your name? I'm sorry.
My name is Leone, L-E-O-N-E, Malcheski from Winona, Minnesota.
Okay.
And I'm delighted to be here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee for listening. And welcome to Winona. We're delighted to have you in our community, and we appreciate your listening and wanting to help the entire state of Minnesota with their transportation issues. I am very much a supporter of the TCMC second train. It would be a huge benefit for the community of Winona. And so do consider passing the bills that are before you. We have, like was mentioned from Paul and the distinguished gentleman from Red Wing as well, a lot of tourism. We have festivals here in Winona, Shakespeare, Beethoven, frozen film. And of course, that is in the middle of wintertime when roads are kind of icy and not too good to drive on. And we have a lot of festivals and activities here and recreation. Our student body in Winona, I helped MnDOT do a study with the Midwest Interstate Highway Passenger Rail Commission. And what that whole commission meeting, that study was to look at college and universities to find out what kind of ridership that was used in the entire Midwest. And the results were that 41% in Winona that responded to the survey do use the train, and 55% actually mentioned that they would use it more if it were more frequent on-time scheduling and more options. So for our universities in Winona, St. Mary's and Winona State and a vocational school, this is a very important issue for them to keep their university costs down and to be able to transport back and forth to their home and so forth. Tourism is huge here, so we make a lot of money, and we're encouraging more so that we can have more state taxes for you and all of the state of Minnesota. Now, to get down to what is maybe more gritty and important for all of you to know and to think about is that our MnDOT State Freight and Rail Planning Division does not have dedicated, sustainable funding. They have to always come to you and say, please, can you give us a little bit more? Can we just have a little bit so we can just, you know, function a little bit? This department does a huge amount for the state of Minnesota and for every community in the state. And I want you to realize that when you didn't give enough funding to this particular entity of MnDOT, because they cannot take the rate of the sale, the gas tax from the roads and bridges because they're a different section, they can only get it from you. And so right now, it's important to understand what happens if you don't have funding for them on a continual basis. And that is that their workflow is sometimes interrupted. They might lose staffing, which had occurred a couple years ago. Projects are delayed. They won't have the ability, perhaps, to apply for federal grants. And we just talked about the need for federal grants for all sorts of infrastructure in rail and freight and for TCMC train and for other aspects of our transportation system. They're the ones that get those funds, apply for them, but if they don't have the staff, they don't have the funding, they can't do it. And if they don't have the matching dollars, they can't get the funds from the federal government, and those dollars are going to go someplace else, and they need to come here in Minnesota because we need them. Next, we want to let you know that it's important what they do for intermodal transportation. They coordinate, you know, the riverfront, barge fleeting, rail, and other freight aspects of transportation all together, and they need that planning dollars to be able to function and make that happen for us. The development and implementation of any intercity passenger rail in the entire state of Minnesota is going to fall into this planning division of MnDOT. And if you don't fund them continuously and without interruption with dedicated funds, they might not be able to function or even implement or even help in actually operating any passenger rail in the state of Minnesota. This is how critical it is. So please find some way. And my suggestion is that you take the rail real estate taxes that our CP Railroads, BNSF, and so forth pay to the state of Minnesota, plus their diesel fuel gas tax that they pay to go into freight and rail. Oh,
Ms. Moshesky, yeah, thank you. We have a number of other people that want to testify, and if you can wrap up quickly or if you're done, that's great. You can submit written comments. We'd like to hear all of your comments, and if you could submit them in writing to our committee legislative assistant, that would be great. Thank you.
Questions?
Oh, we have your comments. Excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you. So I know that Mr. Qualley wanted to testify on this and the other bills. Mr. Qualley, I think rather than having you get up, sit down, get up, come back, we'll have you we'll have you just summarize all of your comments on all of the bills later during the public testimony. So thank you, members. This will conclude our public testimony and question and answer on the second line to Chicago. And now I'd like to call on Representative Torkelson to present again on an informational basis. He has a couple of bills as well, and those are House Files 2504 and 1930. And Representative Torkelson, you also have some testifiers, and we'll call on them as well. So thank you very much. And you'd prefer to be here as well? Not
I think I'll stay here, too, okay. Mr. Chair, okay. Following the lead of Representative Hausman and the little bit different situation we're in today. So thank you, Mr. Sure. Chair, for hearing these bills. Both of these bills relate to freight rail in Minnesota, and especially the short line freight rails. You know, we have a class system of railroads in the state and in the country. The class one railroads really operate under the auspices of the federal government. But the short line railroads really need our local state support in order to function. And these two bills really highlight some of the issues surrounding the short line freight railroads here in Minnesota. As we've been here in Winona over the last couple of days, we've seen how Winona, in particular, is an important transportation hub. If you go down to the harbor today, you'll see barges loaded with the parts for windmills, electric production with windmills. They come in here on barge, but they need to leave here on something, whether it's a train or a truck, in order to get to their final destination. Anytime we can get heavy freight off of our roads and onto the railroad system, it saves wear and tear in our highway system and leaves room for the people that really need to use the highway to get where they have to go, either with a truck or a car. And we have seen, you know, the abandonment of many miles of railroad track over the last few decades. We really can't afford to lose any more, and we need to upgrade those freight rail lines that we do have in place. These two bills highlight that. Mr. Chair, I have a couple of people here that know a whole lot more about this than I ever will, and I think these folks would much rather listen to some expert testimony than mine.
Well, thank you, Representative Torkelson. I want to underline that. Chair Beard, Commissioner Beard, please come up. But I also want to underline the importance of these bills to this region as well, just as Representative Hausman's bills were important to this area, yours are as well, and I'm glad that we have Mr. Beard, who is now a county commissioner in Scott County, but also is here in wearing a different hat today, but really knows a lot about all transportation issues, and appreciate you being here. And of course, Mr. Beard was also the chair of this committee as well at one time. So welcome back to your committee.
Mr. Chairman, I feel like I'm back home, old homely. With some new faces at the table, I see. But yes, thank you for being my loyal foil while I was the chair, as I enjoyed being your loyal foil when you were the chair, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mike Beard. I'm here representing the Minnesota Valley Regional Rail Authority from Redwood Falls, Minnesota. My personal home is in Shakopee, Minnesota. My representative is sitting at the table today. Representative Tapia, it's good to see you.
You too.
Mr. Chairman, two of my favorite topics, well, anything transportation is one of my favorites, but planes and trains are right up there with the best. And so today I'm going to talk about trains, if I may. But before I do, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wagner is behind me to testify.
Yes.
And I know you have a hard stop at some point.
Well, we'd like to stop at 5 or a little after. We have about 8 citizens that want to testify as well. We can get to them maybe about 20 to 5 if you need that amount of time or less.
Well, then I will give you the 20-minute version. I'll try my best to give you the 6-minute version.
Okay, well, I mean, take your time, but we do have some constraints, and I want to make sure that citizens know that they are welcome and we will have time to testify. So 5, maybe a few minutes after 5 is our stop time.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I've been in front of this committee before on behalf of this this piece of railroad track, which is 94 miles of freight rail that was abandoned by the Chicago Northwestern in about 1984 or 85 in that time frame. This was originally part of a grand scheme by investors that formed a company called the Minneapolis and St. Louis Railroad Company, had grand designs of circumventing Chicago back in the 1880s. And we're going to build to Chicago from the Twin Cities. Actually, that's where the name St. Louis Park came from, members, because the railroad never reached St. Louis. It made it to Peoria. And so they somehow prevailed on the city fathers. And what then was, I can't even remember the name of the suburb, but they changed their name to St. Louis Park.
That is fascinating, Mr. Reed. I did not know.
Well, they could have some credibility to the name of their company, but they were heading for the West Coast. Everybody wanted to get to the Pacific. The line we actually are dealing with today is part of that grand design. Made it as far as the Missouri River at one time and has been abandoned over the years back as far as Dawson, Madison, Minnesota. This was abandoned by the Chicago Northwestern in the 1980s, as I mentioned. Was operated unsuccessfully by some severely undercapitalized short line companies until about the year 2000, when 5 counties, as per Minnesota statute, created a regional rail authority and purchased the line from the trustee. The state of Minnesota has helped with that ever since, to the tune of about $34 million to date, which has rebuilt about 41 miles of track with brand new rail ties and ballast, and about 15 new bridges, culverts that have been converted to bridges. What you have in front of you there is a document we prepared a year and a half ago for a Tiger Grant application. Your most recent award to the bonding committee to this rail authority was for $4 million with the permission of the Commissioner of Transportation. We kind of held on to that for about 6 months, and we're going to use that for the local match on the Tiger Grant application. We were not successful in that, so we went ahead and got a phenomenal purchase on some rail and ties, and we converted another 6 miles of the railroad from basically accepted derelict track to class 2 25-mile-an-hour track that can now handle today's locomotives and grain cars. The immediate result of that was a $9 million expenditure by South Central Grain and Energy successor company to open a unit train facility for hauling fertilizer inbound in the city of Gibbon, Minnesota. $9 million of new tax base in Gibbon is a really big deal. And that's happened in every small town along this line over the last 15, 17 years as we've been slowly rehabilitating the line heading west. Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out that there are a couple of ways we could probably fund these going forward. And when Mr. Wagner comes up to talk about the legislation that was passed, I believe, 2 or 3 years ago. It was a takeoff on something we called the FRED study, back when I had the honor and privilege of chairing this committee. Bonding requests were coming through pretty regularly from several legislators who had short line railroads in their districts. And the short lines tend to be able to operate and cover the ongoing operations and maintenance, but it's the capital reinvestment that's the hard part. So building off of a change in the Minnesota Constitution in 1978 under the auspices of Governor Al Quie, when southern Minnesota was looking at losing all of the Milwaukee Road, the Minnesota Constitution was changed by the voters to allow the state to actually make direct cash grants and or no-interest loans to railroad companies for the purposes of building their infrastructure. They can't buy locomotives or railroad cars, they can't pay salaries or operations, but they can build the infrastructure. That change was made by the voters, I believe it was in 1978, the Minnesota Constitution. So since then, the state has participated in many, several rebuild programs around the state, including the line that I'm representing in front of you today on behalf of Representative Torkelson. That led to discussions about, is there a better way to finance this? Is there a better way to do things than have to deal with management budget and have to deal with the bonding committee when there's so many other things that can be done with bonding dollars around the state? And so we formed, asked MnDOT to create a freight rail economic development study. I think it was in 2012, 2011, in that time frame. And it was released in February of 2013. It was released, Mr. Chairman, under your chairmanship. I think it was the day before the Castleton incident.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, in all the smoke and no pun intended, the confusion surrounding that whole thing, the Fred release, kind of got lost in the shuffle. Good work, however, did come out of that, and that resulted in an amendment to or a change to what we called the MRSI program, the Minnesota Rail Service Improvement Act, which had become a very small player in the ability to rehabilitate shoreline railroads. Our plan was to have that amped up and have MnDOT actually make it a program that could make the grants instead of having to deal with the bond house. So that change was made just a couple of years ago under Chair Torkelson's supervision or guidance and getting that through, and I think Mr. Wagner is going to talk about that a little bit in just a few moments. Regardless, we still have an end-to-end-to-end program going on the Minnesota Valley Rail Authority, and so we have a bond request in front of you for $15 million. 2 years ago, it was $20 million. That number is specific because we have two more grain elevators who are begging us for 110-ton railroad cars at 25 miles an hour because they're prepared to invest in unit train loading facilities when we get down the hill to the Morton Yard at the Minnesota River. And so that's why the request is in front of you. Mr. Chairman, I could talk about a lot of other things like how Wisconsin does it, how South Dakota does it, how Iowa does it, and how comes we're left in the dust doing this, doing it this way.
We have your materials. Questions for Mr. Beard, then we'll hear from Mr. Wagner. And I want to just again emphasize there's lots of advantages to this type, and I strongly support this, and there's advantages to this, and we've been talking a lot about climate, and you know, I think this is I mentioned this at the Minnesota Railroad Association conference earlier this summer, and I think this is an important option that is beneficial, and also what Representative Torkelson said about wear and tear on our roads.
Yes.
And we also get many requests for truck weight exemptions, et cetera, and on weight, and that, you know, I'm hesitant about that, and we have an alternative here. So thank you, and questions for our former colleague. Thank you. And Mr. Wagner, and of course, Mr. Beard, please stick around. And if you have other things you wanted to, you know, highlight in Mr. Wagner's conversation, please feel free to do that. And
may I sit right here beside?
Absolutely.
Fun conversation.
Yeah.
I'll make sure I speak into the microphone.
And again, members, we're going to try to wrap this up in 10 minutes or so, and then hear from the public that have waited patiently to testify before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. I appreciate being here. Mark Wagner is my name. President of the Twin City and Western Railroad, as well as the Minnesota Prairie Line, which operates the line that Mr. Beard was talking about. And then I also am president of the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association, which is, and thank you, Mr. Chair, very much for being at our conference this summer. I thought your words were well spoken. And I really like that. The recognition that freight rail is the most greenhouse gas friendly land transportation. Twin City and Western measures its fuel consumption, and last year we achieved 1,000 miles of moving 1 ton of freight, 1,000 miles on 1 gallon of fuel, which would equate into, if you have a 2 ton vehicle, 500 miles to the gallon. So that's pretty efficient. This bill for the $10 million to put in this general fund, as has been stated, the map that shows these short lines in the state, they can fund their operating things, but they inherited infrastructure that was in bad shape to begin with, and so the chickens are coming home to roost. And I know One of the operators right there in the Twin Cities, John Goldman in the Minnesota Commercial, had the Lionel Lakes line rehabilitated, and some businesses expanded because of that. And it's about business development. And the other thing that these short lines can do that the large railroads in the state might not is that we are local. We're in the communities. We're talking to the mayors. We're talking to our county commissioners. And we're talking to the businesses. So we're really have our finger on the pulse. And so this would be very, very helpful. We have a lot of needs in the state, and this would be a competitive process, so it wouldn't be just a giveaway, but it would show some tangible economic benefit. And I'll put in a plug for Winona. I'll admit I got a little bit lost trying to find City Hall, but I did see Bay State Milling. Bay State Milling receives wheat that originates on the Twin City and Western Railroad, so that's pretty cool. Just because the CP goes through Winona doesn't mean Winona doesn't have a short line connection, so that was very cool.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we should talk in a little more detail about the Mercy program itself. The first thing I'd like is to kind of review what's happened quite recently with the Mercy program, and those are the allocations that were made from it, including a rather large allocation to the Stone Arch Bridge in Minneapolis. And I've got nothing against the Stone Arch Bridge, but it did make a big dent in our available resources in the Mercy Fund. But I'd like the testifiers to comment to where we're at with Mercy Funds and that allocation and the other recent allocations that were made from the fund.
Mr. Wagner first, then Mr. Beard, or Mr. Wagner?
Just will make a general comment in that until that provision was changed to a grant, the rules for getting a Mercy loan were very limited. A customer who wants to invest in a freight rail facility to ship by rail, they're limited to $200,000. And $200,000 may not even be enough to build the switch connecting to the main track. And so, so I think to make the Mercy Fund more user-friendly, I think we need to look at raising that limit to, say, $500,000 or $600,000, because then you could actually build the facility. Right now, we're currently working on a customer from Iowa that wants to build a rail spur to bring up Iowa aggregate in acknowledgement of the impending shortage of Twin Cities supplies of aggregate, and they can do it economically by building this on our short line, but they're running into the same issue that, well, $200,000 doesn't get them too much. So that's kind of my area, but I'll let
Mr. Beard.
Mr. Chair, members, I was thinking I had the awards for this year, but I don't see them in front of me. However, I know there were two that worked as short line railroads that needed some specific help, particularly the Minnesota Commercial, which was struggling with a bridge that had washed out. And there was some question on the ownership of the bridge. It appeared that it was a state facility, and they were saying, no, no, it's your facility. Anyhow, the long story short is the bridge is being repaired, and it protects a job base of almost 3,000 jobs up in the New Brighton area. That was under Representative Bernardi's district, I believe. Those jobs were in jeopardy because of the rail service was going to be terminated because the bridge was going to be condemned. When we put this together, here's kind of what we ran into. There were some issues with bonding that gets some bond attorneys involved. You know, they get paid by the word and by finding trouble. That's all. And nothing against them. They protect our creditworthiness and all that. But having smaller projects, like particularly short line railroads, county rail authorities, and things like that, have to deal with $400 an hour lawyers and take sometimes up to a year and a half to get an approval on a funding package when you need to rebuild a switch tomorrow, made it very difficult. And so some of my friends at MnDOT suggested that we have MnDOT create a fund or a mechanism that could be funded, even by bond funds, that they could administer, and we would, it brings some integrity to the process that makes the bond houses comfortable. And that's a very big deal when it comes to shortening timelines and lowering the cost of applying for the money. That is one of the biggest benefits of the new Mercy account. And I applaud you guys for passing that here a couple years ago. But the railroads aren't that sophisticated that we can do this every time we need another capital improvement fund. Removing the strictures that Mr. Wagner just talked about, there was about a $250,000 cap. That doesn't buy a mainline switch on the Burlington Northern. They're about $600,000 now, I'm told. You might get it for $250,000 on March Railroad, but not at the BN. So lifting those restrictions and having them be grants to rail authorities that actually are trying to rebuild their infrastructure, or loans to companies that are extending a siding for the purposes of manufacturing more stuff, that has just been a marvelous invention, and it gets us out of the weeds and with the bond council, and it shortens up the application time and the awards so we can actually make gravel and rail fly faster, I guess.
Thank you. Are there any additional questions for either testify? Do you have any final comments?
Just a couple closing comments, if I may. There are 17 short line railroads in this state. You wouldn't know that, but every one of them was created by basically entrepreneurial endeavor. There are three of them that are owned by rail authorities. When Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota faced the rail abandonment crisis after the Staggered Rail Act in 1980, they immediately intervened directly and purchased most of the roadbeds themselves, made some grants to help rehabilitate bridges and roadbeds, and then hired operators like Twin City and Western to operate their lines. In Minnesota, we took a different tack. We pretty much said, well, good luck to you there. We hope you make it. Twin City and Western was the one that did. They bought their own railroad. The Minnesota Prairie Line, the one I represent, the only way they could do it was to take another route that the legislature created in 1982, I think, and that was the regional rail authorities. County rail authorities, regional rail authorities. There are three regionals that own freight railroads, the one in Rock Nobles County, ours, and then, of course, St. Louis County. They actually have lines that actually have freight running on them. Hennepin County, too, if you want to count the corridor that Twin City Western runs in. A little bit about what happens. One car in every five for the Class 1s originates or terminates on a short line railroad. So we play a significant role, and the Class 1s recognize how important we are in the total transportation mix. Thank you for your attention today. I hope to see you back in session in St. Paul when you can actually vote on this, and we'll talk some more.
Thank you so much. And just to that, we all four of these bills are bonding bills, and they will be considered in our larger capital investment bill that will be a focus of the session. Mr. Wagner, any last comments?
Well, first and foremost, thank you so much for having us here. We really appreciate it. And then I would say that Nobles Rock Railroad changed hands about 2 years ago, and the new operator on it is very proactive, so I suspect you will be hearing from them. They've been very active. Straddle State Lines goes from Minnesota to South Dakota, and they've been very active in South Dakota, and don't be surprised if they visit you next spring. So, which is a good story, because they, too, are going after Grant Laverne and the industries down there, so I think it's a very good thing.
Thank you. I want to correct myself. The second bill that we heard from Representative Torkelson is a general fund. It's not a bonding bill. So we'll have to examine that in the context of if we have some supplemental money to appropriate. So thank you, and appreciate your presence here and traveling to Winona. Members, we have several citizens of Winona in this region that wanted to just testify on various items that on their minds, and so I will call on them, and because our time is short, I'd ask the citizens to keep it to 2 or 3 minutes of testimony, and I have names here. I'll just call them, and Mr. Qualley, I have not forgotten about you, and we'll call on you after our local citizens have had a chance to testify. So Emily Falk, is Emily here? Waiting very patiently in the front row. Thank you very much for coming. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Professor Emily Falk. I teach at Winona State University, and I'm the co-leader of the Winona Climate Action Network. We have several of our members here, and thank you so much, Chair Hornstein and representatives, for hearing us speak on the issues of climate and transportation. And our organization has about 200 members on our email list, and we are actively doing community events in relation to both clean energy and electric vehicles. And we understand that this is a holistic approach, that when you charge your electric vehicle, of course you want it to be charging with clean energy. And so we've had solar power panel discussions. Last night at our meeting, we had several representatives speaking about solar energy, and we understand that part of the mix. We also have a great interest in being able to select from a wide variety of hybrid and electric vehicles, and we really appreciate Governor Waltz's taking this action to support the clean air standards in transportation, because in Winona right now at the dealerships, there's currently zero electric vehicles on the lots. They do not carry them, and with this new standard, they will be compelled to bring more plug-in electric vehicles, plug-in hybrids to the lot so that our consumers can have those as choices. I commute by bicycle, actually, and I would appreciate if more drivers were driving electric vehicles, because then I would not have to breathe in the toxic fumes from their tailpipes when I am riding my bicycle around town. So it is directly related to our health, our clean air, as well as our clean water concerns. And today I'm wearing this red dress. I consider myself a water protector. And October is the month for reducing gender-based violence. And this red dress signifies the missing and murdered Indigenous women. And so all the work that we do to reduce our use of fossil fuels and oil will help benefit and be in solidarity with the Indigenous peoples who are working to end the use of oil pipelines through treaty lands and those kinds of issues as well. I want to say that collectively we can do more than individually, and so we want to be at the table when it comes to regional collaboration on EV corridors. We want to be able to maintain a vibrant downtown, and we see that having electric vehicle chargers, fast electric vehicle chargers downtown, would make a big difference. We have one level 2 charger downtown at the moment, and having fast chargers downtown would be ones that would be universal chargers that would not just be limited to one car manufacturer. And we tried to get Volkswagen settlement monies in the first round, and we were denied. And so we really want to have a voice at the table so that we can speak to those concerns. I know that there's others in the organization who want to speak, and so I just want to say we want to move as quickly as possible to having more electric vehicles and charging infrastructure, and to work towards building this in a bold grassroots movement toward reducing this climate crisis.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your testimony.
Any questions?
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Is Carrie Heckman here still? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Carrie Heckman, and I'm part of a grassroots effort to bring fare-free public transportation to Winona. I first became interested in the issue through my involvement with the Winona Catholic Worker, which offers evening meals to those in need of food or company. One of our regular guests often calls before dinner to see whether anyone will be available to give him a ride home. He takes the bus to us, but dinner is served at 6 o'clock, right around the time the bus stops running, so taking it home afterward isn't an option. If I've biked and no other volunteer is there with the car, I have to tell him, no, I'm sorry, and he's unable to join us. It breaks my heart, and it also got me thinking. Certainly he's not the only person in this town without a car who'd like to go somewhere at night. The buses here don't run on Sundays either, making attending church services, dining out, visiting relatives, Sunday morning activities so many of us value, difficult or impossible for the transit dependent. So I started attending all the meetings I could that had anything to do with transportation, voicing the need for evening and Sunday bus service. At these meetings, I learned that the reason our system provides such limited service is because it's underutilized, and that increasing ridership could lead to expanded service, as it would help justify additional investment. I also learned that 80% of the funding for our local transit system comes from the state of Minnesota. Thank you so much. And that the other 20% comes primarily from fares that could come from elsewhere instead. Since then, fare-free transportation has become my passion. Ridership increases dramatically in fare-free systems. Eliminating fares not only eliminates cost as a barrier to using transit, but also makes transit use more convenient for everyone at every income level. No more fumbling for fares or needing to carry the correct cash amount for every leg of every journey. Communities with fare-free transportation are often the recipients of awards for livability. Seniors on a fixed income are more likely to want to retire in them. And it feels so friendly to board a bus and not be expected to pay a fare. You just feel like you're winning every time. The bus fare in Winona is only a dollar, which for most people is quite reasonable. But consider for a moment my close neighbor. She's a single mom with a part-time job, and she's transit dependent. She's an excellent mother, so when she needs to run an errand, her three kids generally come along. But if she pays fares for herself and for each of her kids, it's $8 round trip, four there, four back. $8 to go to the grocery store, $8 to go to the library, $8 to pick up a prescription. Public transit can be expensive for the user, but it's even more expensive for the taxpayer. It makes much more fiscal sense once you have a system in place and have bought and are maintaining the buses to fill them up. Because as ridership skyrockets, per-person costs plummet. Our hope is to raise $347,000, 20% of Winona Transit's general operating costs for 2020 and 2021, the portion not covered by state funds, for a two-year pilot project. We already have the interest and support of Winona State University and are seeking funding partners among Winona businesses and philanthropists. A friend with experience in state government told me, if you want this project taken seriously, you have to get elected officials behind it. So that's why I'm here today. Fairview Transit has not worked everywhere it's been tried. It's been wonderfully successful, though. In small urban systems in college towns, like Winona. I don't know enough about how state government works to even know what to ask you for, but maybe you know of a way to help make fare-free transit in Winona a reality. Because if it happens in Winona, maybe it can also happen in Mankato and Moorhead and Marshall. And maybe it will catch on in other systems around the country and around the world. Think of the global impact on the environment and the local impact on parking and traffic if we could dramatically decrease the number of vehicles on our roads. Imagine the possibilities for the unemployed if lack of transportation ceased to be an obstacle to employment. Envision a future when the elderly no longer need to worry that giving up driving would mean social isolation. And what if you helped to make it all happen? I think you may have received a handout from John Howe. About the Winona Riders Coalition. It was adapted from a website our group very recently created at winonariders.org. It's a great resource if you'd like to learn more about this project. You can also use the site to get in touch with me. If you have any questions, comments, solutions, or advice, I'd love to hear from you.
So thank you, and thank you. You did a great job, and I appreciate your work very much. And I think there are other municipalities. I think Kansas City has done some work on this. And so, you know, this is not an idea that has not been done in other places successfully. So, you know, we have a free service in downtown Minneapolis, for example, on Nicollet Mall. So I'm really pleased with that you're looking at this, and we will definitely read this and take it to heart. So thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Questions? Okay. Members, we just have a few more folks that I want to make sure testify from the local community. Is Tom Esden here? And I'd ask the testifiers, again, if you could keep it to 2 minutes or under. We have several others that we want to make sure have the opportunity to testify. So thank you, Mr. Esden. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Tom Esden. I'm a resident of Dakota City, Minnesota. at Dakota County, to about 20 miles south of here. And I'd like to talk just briefly, and I'm going to shorten and paraphrase this a little bit to, in the convenience of time here, but I want to talk about the study Accelerating Electric Vehicle Adoption, A Vision for Minnesota. I generally support this, and not only am I just a supporter, but I've been living this for the last 4 years. I've had electric vehicles in the family for the past 4 years, and 2 years we've been totally electric. So we've got some experience and driven around the block several times. One of the first things I want to talk about was one of the first strategies that this report talks about is accelerating sales and use. And while I'm generally not in favor of government incentives, I'm afraid that this might be an example that could sorely use one. And let me give you a personal example. Within the last 30 days, went around to the dealerships, and you've heard that there aren't electric cars available. But I went to the local dealerships and said, "Hey, can I get an electric car? I can talk about it." And basically, I was discouraged from looking at electric cars. The dealership told me, "You don't want an electric car. They're a pain to drive. They don't ride well. They don't drive well. And they were trying to get me into a gasoline car." And I said, "Well, did you take a look at the electric car I'm driving? I wanted to get another one." They kind of joked around, but I think incentives are something that would help fuel this a little bit further. I also applaud the governor's announcement of the Minnesota Clean Car Standards as another step in that direction, again, to force manufacturers and dealerships to provide electric vehicles. And like it was mentioned earlier, on the website, you can't even search for an electric car on some of the local dealers' websites. Even though they sell them, their manufacturer offers them, if you go to their website, if you search for it, you can't even find those cars on their website. So again, offering consumers some type of incentive, I think, would be a real advantage. This isn't just a problem in Winona, it's a problem throughout the state of Minnesota and the country. A lot of the manufacturers just are kind of not very enthused about selling electric cars. And having had one in our family, I'm very enthused. I'm excited for a number of different reasons. One of the second ideas talked about in this document is building out the charging infrastructure. And, I think this goes back to the age-old question of what comes first, the chicken or the egg. And I think that Tesla has been proving this out since their very beginning, because before they started building cars, they built the infrastructure. And now their cars are selling, if I start comparing any other electric car, Teslas are outselling any other electric car. And I think a great portion of that is due to their already existing infrastructure. I can travel anywhere in North America, and frankly, almost any place in the world, because they've built this out. So it is important to have the infrastructure. And that's where here in this part of Minnesota, we're an infrastructure desert. There are no charging facilities of any significance in this part of the state. And thank God for the VW settlement funds, because that's where the majority of funds are coming from to fund this. But again, that's focusing on the larger highway corridors, which is important for long-distance travel. But I urge you not to forget about the local community chargers, the destination chargers. Because again, as we talk to residents within Winona County, and we say, would you be interested? Yeah, I'd like to go electric, but without a charger, I've got ranges. I don't know, why would I do this? And so we think having chargers within the city that are visible in a very prominent location would help remind residents that, hey, this is a viable option. You can see the charger. It's not like chargers have big signs like Quick Trip on the gas station. So I kind of move on. But
yeah, thank you.
And I also think that, don't forget about technology and the innovations that are coming along. Some of the other impediments to electric cars, is the lack of high-density public housing that has charging facilities available. And it's not only the sufficiency of electricity in the garages and parking lots, but it's also Wi-Fi. a lot of the other manufacturers have announced the availability of over-the-air updates and joining Tesla on that. So that's another factor. And again, while those things might be outside of your purview, it's important that, you know, this is kind of considered, you know, as part of a greater transportation. So,
thank you for your testimony. If you have something in writing that you could also submit,
sure,
that's great too. So I'm going to just name the names and so that we can expedite things. If Sheldon Steele is here, we'd like to hear from Mr. Steele. If not, if Tony Chaldek is here from Rushford. Thank you, Tony. And then after Tony, we'll have Janelle Dean and then Scott Sherman.
Yes. My name is Tony Chaldek. I'm the city administrator in Rushford, Minnesota. A couple of years ago, I got to testify in front of the committee here. And a couple of years ago, thankfully, the committee led the charge and got us some small city funding. This year you took a swing at it again. I appreciate it. Didn't quite deliver, but we appreciate it in our small cities. I can get into the details of how many small cities there are throughout the state. I won't do that. I'll just say thank you for what you've done and keep swinging at it. A lot of small cities do use it, and I would defer, I'm going to do a little promo here. If you want to see what we do with those dollars, and you also want to see how much our small community supports the things that you do at the state level, take a look at our Facebook page. You won't be disappointed. Thank you very much. I'm Tony Chaldek, and I will probably be seeing you a little later on this evening.
Thanks so much, Tony. Is Janelle here? And then Scott Sherman still here also? Okay, you're next. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for your patience, and thanks for being here.
Thanks for your patience, too. Janelle Dean, I live in Minnesota City, it's rural, and I don't really like to drive, so extra trains to cities would be awesome, so I'm in favor of that. But I'm also, just want to let you know, I deeply care about the environment, and I'm here to talk about clean transportation. And I added another sentence, the MPCA states in the air we breathe and greenhouse gas emissions report, so that's where that data comes from, is from the MPCA, that we fail to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions to levels set by the Minnesota 2007 Next Generation Energy Act. Because transportation causes over 50% of our total greenhouse gases, the electrification of our transportation system needs to happen as quickly as possible, as is being done in other countries such as France and Norway. To meet goals set forth in the Next Generation Energy Act, we need more education and support for electric vehicles. This especially includes supportive infrastructure which allows EVs to easily and quickly charge throughout Minnesota. The Southeast Minnesota Highway 61 corridor is particularly lacking in infrastructure. We need more high-speed charging stations along the 61 corridor north to the cities. I'd like to point out that most EVs are charged at home, but when traveling long distances, EV owners seek out high-speed chargers. The nearest high-speed charger is currently located in Red Wing, Minnesota, and I've learned that people drive EVs choose to bypass Scenic Highway 61 because there are minimal ideal charging options available. I'd also like to let you know that EV drivers want to charge while they dine or shop, so locating stations near local businesses in places like downtowns welcome visitors and helps to increase tourism and income for local businesses, and I think makes life like way better than stopping at Walmart or Hy-Vee every time you need a charge. To reduce greenhouse gas emissions, we also need to help provide affordable EVs to Minnesotans. I'm so thankful for the Clean Car Standards Initiative set forth by Governor Walz. This will help quite a bit in moving us forward. I'd also like to say that I brought a petition that was signed by over 200 individuals, primarily residing in the Winona area, that are in favor of planning for a Winona Transit EV bus and installing a public charging station in downtown Winona. It was not difficult at all to acquire signatures. Some people pulled the clipboard out of my hand, and I'd say like maybe 5 out of 6 people, if not more, wanted to sign the petition. And I'd like to say, too, that education part is really important because the other people that weren't sure didn't know what an EV was, so I got to educate them on what EVs were. So this petition was submitted to the city in July, but I regret to inform you that the city administration does not believe the city should be in the business of providing energy to vehicles. City administration also feels the cost of an EV minibus, such as the city of Winona would need, is cost prohibitive. I would like to ask representatives here today to help provide more financial support to Winona for EV infrastructure and to help Winona transition to being a cleaner city.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, I have a petition.
Yeah, we would very much like a copy of the petition. And thank you for your advocacy. People, it just makes a difference when folks are getting out there and getting petition signatures. And very much appreciated. Okay, so we're winding down, members. We have Scott Sherman and Sam Strenkins, and then we'll hear from Mr. Qualley and anyone else who is not able to testify that wants to. But we have pretty much a hard stop at 5:15 here. So
I'm going to stand. I'm going to talk loud.
Good.
My name is Scott Sherman. I'm a cyclist. This represents my family. Me, my wife, my 19-month-old son. I have another one coming in December.
Congratulations.
17-year-old. I figured these, if nothing else, would stick in your head. You'd be like, that is the guy from Winona who bikes. In town here, I'm known as the bike guy. I'm also known as the outdoor rec guy. Okay? I should also be over at DNR and Legacy meeting because we have a very important legacy grant that we're applying for right now. This one is more important to me because this one involves the safety of the people in our community. I grew up in Eagan, west of 35E. I worked at the Shakopee Theater. I played soccer in Blaine. Blaine? Another Blaine over here? Right? Yep. I played soccer in the National Sports Center up there. I grew up in the Twin Cities. In the Twin Cities, I have commuted over 26,000 miles by bicycle from Eagan to Shoreview, Bloomington, Rosemount. I've seen a lot on my bicycle. Down here, and since, I've put in 100,000 miles on my bicycle. I'm a traveling sales rep by trade. I've driven over 1 million miles. What does that say? That says that I've seen it all. I've seen it everywhere. I've seen it here in the Twin Cities. Kudos to you. Most of you are from the Twin Cities area. Kudos to the infrastructure that you have designed up there. I used to be able to ride my bike up there. I knew every single person who was on a bicycle. Now I ride, I know no one. Why? Because there are so many cyclists up there. So many people that travel by bicycle. Kudos to each one of you for giving that opportunity to those people. I'm not here for me. I'm here for Winona. I'm here for my community. I'm here for my family. I'm here for my little guy. Reason being, we need bicycle infrastructure, just like the Twin Cities does. I moved here in 1991 to come to school. I moved back up to the Twin Cities. When I came back down here, I saw severe lacking of bicycle infrastructure. I rode my bicycle here today. I came within 2 feet of being struck today, right in front of City Hall, as the bus was pulling up, by an older woman, who just wasn't looking for a bicycle as she pulled out of the grocery store parking lot. Why is that? Because she's not used to having bikes on the streets. Any single piece of funding goes in front of you, please consider bicycle infrastructure, pedestrian infrastructure. It is there for safety, convenience, health, and wellness. That is what I'm about. That is what I would love to see our legislature be about. I can solve the problems for public health and safety. Ride your bike. Have that infrastructure in place. I can solve the problems for MnDOT. Ride your bike. That's all I have. Thank you very much for coming to Winona and being here for us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is Sam Strenkins here? Okay. Mr. Qualley? And then is there anyone else who is in the public here who would like to testify that didn't sign up that wants to? We don't have a lot of time, but Yeah. So, Mr. Qualley, quickly, you'll be our last testifier. I know there were many, many things on your mind, but if you could keep it to a couple of minutes, then we would appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, I've had gavels thrown at me before, so I will be mercifully brief. My name is Philip Qualley. I'm state director for the railroad workers, and I just wanted to mention that, number one, 39 years, I actually hold seniority to switch the Bay State Mill and worked on the Minnesota Valley Line with Mr. Beard, former Chairman Beard. We support all of the four bills before you today. However, we would like to mention respectfully that with House File 1930, we do believe there should be some element of disclosure, of ownership disclosure. Let me be very clear. We not only support the bill, we think the funding should be much greater. We have absolutely no issue with our fine corporate citizens, the Minnesota Valley Regional Authority or the Twin City and Western. However, you should be aware that with the short line conglomerations across the United States, we simply believe good government and ownership disclosure is reasonable, and frankly, more funding would be appropriate for the short lines in Minnesota. We have for the 1,200 railroad workers in Minnesota, we have delivered a handout to you. This essentially, and for the public, this essentially encapsulates my comments, and I hope you'll take a look. We stand by the polling work that was in the handout, as well as the, we'd like you to see the Midwest Interstate Passenger Rail Commission, the amount of federal funds that have been sent to Wisconsin, Michigan, and Illinois. And as well, I've put together some excerpts abstracted from the federal state corridors that are being built out across the United States. My closing comment is very simply this. I respect that the state of Minnesota has to be aware of the costs and the many competing needs in our state. But for southeastern Minnesota, of which the Qualley family owns in Houston County in the Caledonia area, these state corridor services are essential to the growth of Minnesota. And while we look at it as being an expense, perhaps, it is really an investment with exponential economic return. Business commuters, artists, tourism, connecting families. I hope you'll take a good look at the two bills, and thank you very much for your comments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Qualley. Before we adjourn, I wanted to see if Representative Torkelson had any final concluding comments. This is our tradition here, and then I'll have a couple of very brief comments, and then we will adjourn.
Well, first I want to make it clear that I never threw my gavel at Mr. Qualley. I may have thought about it, but I never did it. Well, I just want to thank...
Now that's funny.
Thank my testifiers that came to testify to my bills today. I know they drove quite a ways to come, and I appreciate their expert testimony. I'd like to thank the chair for hearing those bills. Thank you, Chair Hornstein. I'd like to thank the members who... paid attention all afternoon. It's been a long session, but especially thank the community of Winona and the public that members that have come and shown interest in our work. I hope you see that we do work pretty hard at our jobs and try to take in all perspectives as we work through the very difficult work of determining how best to address transportation issues here in the state of Minnesota. With that, have a great evening, everybody.
Yeah, and thank you very much, Representative Torkelson, and members of the public. I would just echo what Representative Torkelson said. You got a little snapshot of generally what we do. And I would, again, to the citizens who testified, I think all of the issues that you raised will be addressed in the regular session. I think for the authors of the two bills we heard, those bills will be addressed in the regular session as well. And then to the public sector folks, the city and county people, we'll be putting together another transportation bill. And I think your input is very helpful and valuable with that. For everyone, their input is helpful and valuable. So our regular session does start on February 11th, and we'll end, I guess, are you constitutionally required a deadline sometime in the third week of May? What's the date?
Usually around May 20th.
Yeah, on or around May 20th. And so we welcome all of your involvement and participation up until the session and during the session, everyone has raised really, really important issues that affect all of us. And so, again, with much appreciation for people's testimony and concern, we will continue to listen and to be in contact as we develop legislation coming up. So with that, members, before we adjourn, for those members of our committee and staff that are interested, we will be boarding the buses one more time. We have a quick boat tour to look at some of the bridge infrastructure from a different perspective. And so that will just be about a half hour, but the bus will take us there and then take us back to where we need to be at 6 o'clock today. So with that, we are adjourned.
Oh, we got into that one.